You're listening to the oneofus.net podcast network.
Fans of podcast horror and Halloween, Friday, October 25th in Austin, Texas at the Nomad Bar at 1213 Corona Drive, we have got an event for you. Attack of the Pod People is an unprecedented party to celebrate the season featuring members of oneofus.net, Double Toasted, The Night Owl, Horror Queers, Junk Food Cinema, Castle of Horror, Rage Select, Women in Caskets, and the Threequel Club, all performing onstage tributes to the season. All that, and you can get up and sing with Karaoke Underground or compete in our costume contest with prizes. RSVP is required for entry, so look our event up on Facebook or Eventbrite and join us.
OneofUs.net and all of the shows on it are 100% subscriber-supported. Please consider becoming a subscriber to OneofUs.net, keep the site and all of our great shows going, and get some terrific bonus content as well.
So shut up, you fucks. We got a new Geeks at Large going. I know, it's like the first one in a decade. It's great. Just want to let you know that we... I was going to make a joke about we were like bought out by Disney.
Four more months.
You guys don't want to listen to us for another year, but I'm afraid we can't. We have no choice but to post our tri-decade podcast. Whatever that word is, post it in the comments what that actual word is.
All three of our listeners posted in there.
And all three of them are Stephen.
Yeah. We post so sparsely these days that I have tried brainstorming ways to make the podcast like less relevant. Like I'm actively trying to make it less relevant. Like, let's stop worrying about being relevant.
Yeah.
Make it sound like you're trying to sabotage what's not even a thing.
Like, I'm just saying, Putin like, said that he didn't do it.
Like, the least
so, and I believe him.
It's like, wow. It's like you're trying to sabotage Arbor Day, a thing that no one acknowledges.
Yeah, pretty much.
Like, I'll tear this shit down. I'll tell you that much. No one's going to enjoy Arbor Day anymore. All two people, all environmentalists. So...
Well, I got sad all of a sudden, so that's okay.
I don't know.
I forgot about Arbor Day.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's the point everyone
just
did.
Like people forget about Geeks at Large, which is the podcast you may be listening to. If not, what the fuck are you doing here? How are you listening to this? I'm your host, Taylor, and I'm joined by... You've got your name. That's fine. I'm going to give you a new name. Your new name's Carl. Oh. Anyone, give it up for Carl.
Yay!
I don't want to give it up for Carl.
Well, that would be conceited.
That's
why
a
would
total
you give it up?
Carl move.
Hi, I'm Neil.
It's a power play by
Carl.
Oh, we have a fourth person joining us, Neil, the doppelganger of Carl.
I miss Carl already.
Yeah, me too. Anyway, and you are?
I'm Stephen.
Oh, see, Stephen's on the ball. He's fucking on the ball. All right. Anyway.
I was just going to say, when you were bringing up, like, you know, if you are listening to this, or maybe you are listening to this, well, if we're going to introduce the concept of Schrodinger's podcast listener, we're opening up, like, a whole dimension that I just don't have the emotional energy to get into.
Maybe we just, you know, tell Tinkerbell to believe hard enough, the podcast will exist.
Our next podcast recording will literally be, like, an audio will and testament for us.
It's going to be like just ASMR, but it's going to just be us snoring. It's going to be like an 8-hour podcast.
The original ASMR.
Yes. Old Jebediah did that back in 1842. Founder of ASMR.
Going to the doctor and listening to your parents snore.
Is that what they called it? I thought it was wrestling.
What?
Speaking of wrestling, we're talking about Mindhunter Season 2.
I think that might have been the worst transition we've ever had.
Well, you know what? Time's money, and we're not making any of it, so fuck it.
We're
going to go
not.
For... That's it. We're going to be off the air for another 2 years. Goodbye.
We're literally not making any money. Yeah, there you go.
There you go. We died of exposure. That's what happens. That's why it took so long to recover. God.
It's only getting worse. All right. How's everyone doing? Hi.
Hi.
I'm good.
Hi, yeah. All one. Hi, that's pretty good.
Yeah, I'm pretty good.
All right. That's great. What a great podcast. Okay, we did it.
All right.
A podcast.
See you in 6 months.
Yeah. No, you're aiming high.
A podcast of people agreeing with each other. That's exactly what I wanted. Okay, so I feel like for the record, I should point out that we did actually attempt to record an episode of Geeks at Large about the finale of Game of Thrones.
Back in May,
because if there's one thing the internet needed one more of, it was... two white people on a podcast talking about the finale of Game of Thrones. But Taylor and I sat there and talked about it for...
hour and a half, probably?
It was about 2 hours, actually.
Maybe two hours.
It was pretty long. And what happened was there was a technical gaffe where somehow the connection with Taylor's microphone became just a slightly undone. And right before we started recording, like right when we synced everything up and right as we were about to launch into actually starting the podcast... his connection failed, and it sounded like it was just me talking aggressively about Game of Thrones to myself for 2 hours, and then I would get really quiet for a few minutes, like I said something I didn't like.
It's a really boring, annoying version of like that opening scene from Raging Bull, where Jake LaMotta is just talking in a mirror to himself, trying to do a stand-up.
I prefer the ending of Boogie Nights, but with twice as many penises.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
All right. That's four penises.
Take that, Game of Thrones. I'm already doing better there than they were.
Yeah. You want some
Marky Mark.
Gross.
Marky Mark's a little Marky Mark.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm
out. Brought it up, Neil. It's your fault.
I know.
And in hindsight... one of the reasons why we never re-recorded it is because, one, we were just kind of exhausted at that point, because it was kind of in the midst of all of the Game of Thrones discourse, and it was just like, we were already kind of going into it, like, more out of, like, obligation, because it was like, okay, well, we should talk about it.
Yeah.
But also, we were so burnt out about all, I don't even call them hot takes at that point, but it was just like, you know, it's just so much discussion about it.
Yeah.
And...
I think our goal should be to talk about things that we really, really want to talk about.
Well,
worry less about what's relevant, worry less about...
But I don't want to say that we didn't want to talk about it.
Yeah, yeah.
But, I don't know, like... And then when
a re-recording wouldn't have been
re-recording just kind of takes so much wind out of your sails, honest, because we're already busy enough and kind of making time for it.
In fairness, it was a good discussion. It was a good recording. It was one that I actually would have enjoyed listening to, and I think somebody might have gotten out of it. Somebody might have gotten something out of it. And I mean, like, I did genuinely want to talk about it. I had my little defenses of it. I genuinely enjoyed talking about, like, a retrospective of the series as a whole. Mm-hmm. I thoroughly enjoyed that. The problem was, like, I gave so much into that. You know, like, I know that sounds like such a very diva thing to say. Like, I gave so much of myself into that recording. Mm-hmm. But I gave so much in that recording, and it went for so long that I'm going to be honest. Like, I kept telling Taylor, like, hey, if you want to re-record sometime, let me know. But, like, complete, like, 100% transparency, if we were going to have to record that again, I was just tired. I was like, I kind of don't want to. It's just so much.
Yeah.
And, like, I felt like I got everything out. Like, it was good to get everything out. Like, you know, if you listen to it, you could hear me kind of working through my feelings on a lot of Game of Thrones things. But then once you're done...
But you'll never hear it, so...
That's the problem. Unless you're my family, my roommates, or my girlfriend, you're just not going to hear it.
It's hard to recreate that level of catharsis of releasing.
Well, yeah, and also, I think there's... Again, breaking that... Our favorite thing to do, which is recommend better things to do with your life than listen to Geeks at Large.
Yeah.
That's our motto at this point.
Listen, that's my thing.
Certainly the 107th best thing you could listen to at this very moment.
Yeah.
Tied with the yelling from your neighbors and your own inner thoughts about your existential crisis.
Listen, your neighbors are up to something. I'm just saying.
Just saying. It's totally a shallow grave up there. So,
God damn it.
And I think, too, total transparency on my part here, Go watch the Lindsay Ellis videos about it. It's like she's honestly kind of opened up my eyes to some of the problems too, and it's like, you know what? She's got a point, because it's very thorough, and you know, other discourse, but that's the one that I really wanted to hear.
Because you don't get to be a Hugo Award nominated person without being thorough, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So, yeah, you know. And it's changed my mind, so, like, my opinions then probably would not match my opinions now 100, you know, 1-to-1, so.
Would you say they've gotten worse?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
All right.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
What? Okay.
But Ghost still got a pat, and that was pretty neat.
That was pretty neat.
That was the best part. Yeah.
I will maintain that, like, I liked the finale more than most people. I really don't care for this last season. Like, it has, I think it has, like, two really fucking fantastic set pieces that work if you just kind of don't think about it. And I think that
you shut your brain off.
And if, yeah, I mean, like, I will say, like, the battle for Winterfell is really fucking
impressive.
You're
like Daenerys and you just forget that you, what was the thing that the showrunner said?
Oh, she just forgot that there was an army there.
Like, she forgot that there was an army
themes
there.
Themes are for essays or for book reports.
Like, I like the finale more than most, I think. Like, I when it ended, I said to my girlfriend, I'm satisfied. I wasn't ecstatic, and I'm going to be completely honest. Ever since Game of Thrones ended, I haven't thought about it.
Mm. That's something.
Yeah.
That says probably more than we could ever say in that podcast.
I haven't thought about it. I've just been like, oh, yeah, that was a show I watched. Okay, cool.
Well, that's the thing, too, is that, you know, in Lindsay Ellis videos in the second one, her kind of final point is just about, like, it's kind of like what we ended up talking about, which is, like, the legacy of the show.
Yeah.
And she gets into how, like, you know, oh, we retell stories, and, like, how many adaptations of Romeo and Juliet are there? We all know how it's going to end. But also looking at, like, you know, Game of Thrones or something like Dexter, where, like, Dexter has a really shitty ending.
Oh,
I mean, obviously it was bad before that.
Yeah.
But it has a bad ending.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so you're never going to, when you watch, you know, Dexter again, you're not going to watch the bad seasons, you know?
Unless you're a masochist.
Unless you're a masochist. And she does go into, like, why, you know, at least for her, and I don't want to speak for her, go watch the video, I guess, at this point, but she does talk about, like, the legacy is her. Like, it's different than, like...
Seriously, guys, stop listening to whatever garbage you're listening to now. Watch that Lindsay Ellis.
Yeah, man. Pause this podcast, go watch it, and then never come back to this podcast.
We don't want you.
We don't want you. Go away. We don't deserve you.
It's definitely like an Air Bud. Like, you're just throwing broken bottles at our listeners.
Get out of here. Get out of here. Go.
Yeah. We're that kind of abusive boyfriend that, like, keeps,
don't
like,
call throw, us abusive, Steven. It's 2019.
Keep throwing, like, ourselves a pity party.
Oh, my God.
It's just, like, guilt-tripping people to listen to us at this point.
You mean me in college? All right. Boy, can I speak there. I'm just kidding. Anyways, you were saying before we wrap up.
I'm just imagining, like, someone editing that to, like, sound really bad. So it's like Steven, like, an abusive boyfriend. And Neil going, like me in college.
Oh, God.
And it's like, oh, no.
Oh, boy.
Steven, abusive boyfriend, .. Neil, like me in college.
Completely, like different audio quality. Yeah. Well, there, super staticky.
Well, there go my chances of running for president. All right.
Yeah, you're going to get elected.
Good point.
There you go.
I just got to disparage brown people enough, and then they'll be like, that's my guy.
Wow.
That one.
Anyway.
And that one you sitting on her sweet,
sweet candy. Anyway, enough talking about not good television. Let's talk about good television.
All right.
Like Mindhunter.
Yay.
So, we did do a season one review.
It was like two episodes ago.
Yeah. It was actually last episode. We had 2 years. We wanted to be a companion piece.
Yeah.
So it's 2 year gap. We're like seasons of Rick and Morty. That's what we are.
But our fan base, rather than being shitty, is just kind of non-existent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is better.
Yeah.
I'd rather have a non-existent fan base than a shitty one.
I would agree.
Yeah.
I have to agree on that.
So Pat yourself on the back, half listener.
I don't even want to get into what would constitute that.
I don't know. It's like that 2.5 children thing. Mm. That 0.5 children.
That half listener is literally somebody who's like listening to us while they do something else. So they're literally like half listening.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like they have a YouTube video up while the podcast is going.
They just make like smoothies.
They're watching really loud stuff. They're watching a Twitch live stream of like a speed run of like Conker's Bad Fur Day while they listen to us.
They're watching Chicago. Like they're just watching musicals.
Meanwhile, they're watching the speedrun going, I'd really rather you be quiet.
This is really great background noise. I'm just going to listen to it here. And then they, like, start singing. Anyway, Mindhunter.
Mindhunter, yes.
All right.
Neil.
Hey.
Would you like to pick us up where we last left off our intrepid Mindhunterers in Mindhunter Season 1, at the end of Mindhunter Season 1?
Oh, boy. Okay. Give me a second. Okay, so at the end of season one, because I did actually watch the finale with you and Sabrina.
More like the finale, am I right?
Anyways, so in the finale of season one, there was discord among the group. One of them, we all knew who it was Fark and Greg, had betrayed them by sending in the supposedly damaged tape, which was incriminating against Holden Ford, played by Jonathan Groff.
Can't stop the Groff.
Anyways, so
Can't stop till you get a Groff.
Anyways, it ends with the whole gang in discord. None of them believes each other, and there's huge tension. And as a result, Holden Ford breaks up with his girlfriend, and he goes over and visits Ed Kemper, who has made an attempt on his life. And in the end, Ed Kemper scares the shit out of Holden so bad, Holden Ford has an anxiety attack. And then it also cuts over to BTK burning all of his drawings, and that's what lets you in that he's BTK.
Led Zeppelin plays.
And also Led Zeppelin plays. I don't know how much money went into that, but probably a healthy chunk.
Back in Black was an interesting choice, but I love Led Zeppelin. So.
Deep Purple's Highway Star was an interesting choice.
Anyways, so that's the ending of season one. So season two,
yes,
finds that the old director has retired due to, like, supposedly, like, retired in scare quotes, but it's actually because he's been kicked out due to Holden Ford's antics. Mm. So as a result, a new director is coming in, and rather than being very disparaging and unhelpful and discouraging, he's actually very super helpful to a kind of weird degree. And what he wants to do is he wants to push forth the behavioral sciences unit into becoming the actual textbook standard for how people deal with serial killer cases.
I'm pretty sure their new boss's title is like official party conversationalist.
Yeah.
It's like he furthered the department solely so he could have like interesting cocktail party conversations with people.
Exactly.
Hey Larry, come hear about fucking Manson and shit. Get a load of this.
So, but there's a whole bunch of stuff going on too. Somehow the gang gets wrapped up in the Atlanta child murders. I just realized that what I described sounded like "And It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia" episode. The gang gets wrapped up in the Atlanta child murders, which happened in Atlanta between 1979 and 1981, where upwards of 30 children, black children, went missing in Atlanta. Only some
went missing and were never found. Some were found dead.
Some were found dead. Yeah.
To this day, like, it was supposedly solved, but to this day, it's not really been. And they've also just reopened the case as of this year. So that's really, really cool. I would say, like, you know, a good, like, the, like, two-thirds of the season is dedicated to the Atlanta child murders.
Yeah, that's cool.
So, yeah.
Especially the last, like, four episodes.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So.
Oh, yeah. So, there you go. And also, like, we meet serial killers along the way.
We meet serial killers, Tench's marriage and fatherhood is kind of called into question.
Yes.
Holden is...
Feeling like He's got some issues.
He's dealing with panic attacks and stuff, so he's dealing with panic attacks.
Well, he's dealing with the repercussions of his encounter with Ed Kemper
right.
at the end of season one, because he has a panic attack, and that's where we mm-hmm. leave him. And episode one of season two opens with him in a hospital bed, you know, strapped down.
Yep.
And still, it's basically like a day later.
Yeah.
Which is really, really a big middle finger to us, because it was like 2 fucking years.
Well, because like when I was watching it with you and Sabrina, and it went over to the next, like, you know, we finished season one and then you just started season two, and Sabrina said something kind of like, oh, I'm so glad we can just go right into the second season. And it was kind of like, yeah, fuck the rest of us that had to wait 2 years
yeah.
for yep. it to come back.
Yep.
Yeah.
And literally no time has passed in the show.
Yeah.
It's exactly. literally, oh, he has a panic attack. Oh, he's in a hospital bed. He's feeling a little better.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah. Of course, David Fincher. Is David Fincher considered a co-creator? Is he just like a producer slash director?
No, he's a co-creator. He created it with Charlize Theron.
Okay.
Because Charlize Theron was a big fan of the book and had wanted to work with David Fincher, and she talked with him and was like, you're a serial killer guy, right? And he was like, yeah.
Yeah, I guess so.
I wish you would phrase it differently.
So they created the series. And
he's
really
like wearing like a burlap sack over his head and like cleaning his chainsaw.
It's really I had a joke and I lost it. It's fine. Which is, and it's really crazy to consider that Charlize Theron is a creator on this show.
Yeah, it's dope.
Like,
cool.
Which makes me wonder, like, if they're opening the door to, like, in the future seasons of maybe doing Alien Wuornos. Which, as far as I'm concerned, John Douglas and co. never interviewed Alien Wuornos.
Yeah.
So that would be, I guess then the question becomes, how strictly do they want to adhere to history?
No.
And right. that's not for me to decide, because
so up
I don't
to this
work on
point
the show.
Is pretty accurate to John Douglas's actual experiences, like talking to
sort of. I mean, like talking to the people, yes. Okay. But I mean, like they take liberties with it, obviously, and
right. That's why it's not him; it's Holden
yeah.
Ford.
Yeah,
Holden
exactly. Ford. And I don't know how. Like, I know that Douglas was involved with the Atlanta child murders investigation, but I don't think it was quite to the extent that it was in Mindhunter.
Right.
Which, I mean, once again, you gotta change some stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, you know, John Douglas's partner, when interviewing Charles Manson, wasn't getting really offended about childhood allegories and whatnot, so
Parallels between yeah. Manson and himself raising yeah. their flock.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, it's, you know, obviously, stuff like that is taken, is given creative license, but also like the character, the black FBI guy,
yeah, Barney, Jim
based,
Barney,
based on a real person.
Hey,
that's
father
really cool.
of Jim Varney.
God damn it! Okay,
yeah, I said it.
Like apparently, the dude survived an attempt by his ex-wife to kill him, like with a hitman. So that's fucking interesting.
I've done that.
No, you haven't.
Twice.
No, you haven't.
So fuck you.
It's not like it's not nice to listen to our to like lie to our listener.
Listener apostrophe parentheses S.
Yeah. So yeah, that's my summary of Mindhunter season two, or at least my log line for it.
Your log line.
Yeah.
So basically, I guess first question first, is this an improvement over season one? Is this a better season?
I would say yes, but it's also very different from season one.
But it's still the same show, Neil. Fucking man up and fucking pick one.
I would say season two is the better season. Season one is fucking fascinating. And I enjoy the depths that it's plumbing. But yes. You can't do another season one. It's just like, you've already done it. If you just keep going down this road, it's just going to be the same thing over and over again. So apparently there was a big change out of the writing room, of the writer's room for this show. And it's a bit evident. Like, you know, you see some of the like names of the writers popping up in season one, but they're popping up in other, like in other positions. And then in season two, all of a sudden, oh, they're writers for the show now. So there was a big turnaround, and I think it was for the better, honestly. Mm-hmm. Because season one, I think one of the things that I used to like kind of get people interested in season one of Mindhunter is that it is very much the anti-CSI.
Yes.
You know, there's no crazy sensational murders that happen in the show, in season one, or, you know, or the show.
They're actually, the show. What's kind of great about the show is that it hides a lot of the violence.
Yes.
Because you start the season, you have the scene with the hostage taker,
and
he's suicidal, and Holden is trying to negotiate him out of killing the hostages, etc.
Yeah.
And he eventually takes the shooter, hostage taker...
Shotgun
to the head, to himself.
Which
and
is...
It's really fucking bloody. Yeah.
It's not even that it's bloody, it's sudden.
It's very sudden, it's surprising, and, like, that's kind of the goriest that it gets.
That's the only murder that happens
on screen on the show.
Aside from, like, the little murder investigation that's going on in the middle of season one, the only murders, like, all the murders that take place in the show have all taken place, like, decades ago.
Or, like, 5 years or something, like in the case of Ed Kemper.
Yeah, oh, yeah, that's true. But they've all taken place years ago.
So it's kind of like Zodiac.
Yes.
Speaking of Fincher, like you see the Zodiac guy like rob the people at that one point, but you don't really like see much of the crimes, right? Like in that.
I mean,
movie?
You see him murder people.
You see him shoot people and stuff because, like, obviously you have the opening.
I don't remember the violence all that much, and it's
because there's not a ton of it, and honestly, it's
kind of. I don't want to say it's the least interesting part of the movie, but it's not what the movie's about.
Yeah.
It's not what the movie's about.
Also, Fincher decides to kind of, I don't want to say showcase it because that makes it sound like insensitive.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But the way he frames it is the most interesting, respectful way to do it,
I suppose,
because it's not exploitative. It's not sensational.
Yeah.
And sometimes you have very, like, interesting detached sense to it, like the one with the taxi cab driver, where you just see a person get in the cab.
That's the one I really remember. You've got
the opening one with the two kids at Lover's Lane, which is probably the goriest part, and even then it's just like it's more the bluntness of it that is striking about it, because it's just you're watching two people get shot in slow motion.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it's not like, you know, Platoon or something.
No.
Yeah.
And then you have the couple getting killed by the lake later in the movie,
Which is upsetting.
It is very upsetting, as it should be.
But it's aside from some CG blood, it's not terribly gory.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Mindhunter follows a lot of the same principles where it more hints at the violence and the crimes. Like, you'll see... You're kind of in the mind of the... Mindhunter. In the position of Ford and Tench and Carr, in that you're kind of seeing it secondhand. You're seeing it after the fact. You're just seeing crime scene photos, and you're trying to absorb the thoughts and this psychological mindsets of the killers.
Mm.
And I think that's a really smart way of doing it. Like you said, it's the anti-CSI. Obviously has, like, oh, here's, like, seven fucking bodies. Oh, man, he jumped from this fucking window. Bah, bah, bah.
It's very sensationalized in the way it portrays murder and whatnot. It's very, like, ooh, watch these camera tricks. It's really obnoxious. And it's very distasteful. I think that a good way to compare and contrast David Fincher's approach to this stuff, especially with Zodiac, is there were two Zodiac films that came out around the same time. One of them came out in 2006, just called Zodiac. It's this very fictionalized film about two cops, one young, one old. One of them's grizzled, and the other one, he drinks a lot and he smokes more, so that's how you can tell the case really bothers him.
He vapes and he's got a big rock hard cock all the time.
Sure, why not? Yeah,
he watches Rick and Morty.
God damn it.
Galaxy Brain.
Yeah. But with that one, the murders are very sensationalized. Like, they're very, like, handheld, people screaming, you know, like, music swelling. It's very distracting. And then you look at Zodiac, which is very detached in it, and it's very sudden. It's not relying on it at all. It's more upsetting and disturbing and almost voyeristic, but not in a disrespectful way. It's voyeuristic in a detached, like, you wanted to see people get murdered, well, here you go.
Well, it's
not fun.
Well, it feels like a true crime documentary almost. Like,
yeah, it's a, it's a docudrama.
Like a docudrama. It's like you were mm-hmm. watching like American Justice or yeah. like, not Forensic Files because that one's a little campier, but like, you know, almost like a less sensational Dateline where it's just like, yes. here's crime scene photos. You don't really see the body. You're just kind of hearing from people. You know, you
a
hear...
A current affair.
Okay, yeah, exactly. yeah. You listen to, you know, you just kind of get the facts. It's like just the facts, Jack, you know.
The sensationalized stuff sounds like it's trying to put you at the center of the action and then trying to make the action as interesting and dramatic as possible.
Yeah.
Whereas something like David Fincher tries to, like, put you in the position of something that's not all that different than you are already is that you're... Like, you've heard of it, you know information about it, you're getting a closer look, but not a particularly sensationalized version. You're just kind of getting what realistically probably happened, which might not be the most interesting thing to watch, but it's still upsetting.
It's compelling.
And it's very compelling. Yeah. Well, it's just kind of... The kind of mundanity of how Zodiac kind of...
Yes.
Just goes up to those people picnicking and robs them and stuff, it's disturbing and just kind of how like how easy that could happen.
Yeah, and just how like kind of harmless it seems to start off. Like, you know, they almost treat it like a joke and then it's like within a switch, like in the flip of a switch, mm-hmm. it gets real serious real quick.
Yeah. Well, and then, you know, with Zodiac, Fincher does a really great job of kind of using the mystery of it, because we never find who the Zodiac Killer is.
Right.
Spoilers for the Zodiac killings.
Like
find out who it is.
They have like a big suspicion about John Carroll Lynch.
Yeah.
And I think the movie ends with the McPoyle guy, like, you know,
saying that's him.
Pointing to him.
And then in the epilogue, you know, with the text on the screen, it basically says DNA
died.
Ruled him out.
Oh yeah, DNA ruled him out. Yeah,
or like the DNA.
It was like his handwriting too. The handwriting was
thing. The handwriting didn't match.
The whole DNA. Zodiac investigation was essentially like
reasonable
beyond a reasonable doubt.
Yeah,
it's full of reasonable doubt. Thank you.
Yeah.
That was great podcasting. There we go.
Yeah.
Good job, team. Okay. Yeah, it's just filled with reasonable doubt. It's like, well, this suspect has a lot of stuff against him, but also this in their favor, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. I remember showing Ryan, our friend Ryan Zodiac, and we had this interesting conversation afterwards of, like, it's kind of interesting, like, how much it takes to get a conviction, and then whether that's a good or bad thing.
Yes.
You know? Like,
it depends.
Obviously, context and different circumstances.
I was about to say, it depends on a case-by-case basis,
right.
But yeah, it can be very,
exactly.
very frustrating.
And I think, to your point about how a lot of TV shows portray crime and stuff, kind of, it's missing the forest for the trees.
Right.
Where it's like, it's the instant gratification
of
like, oh, the violence.
It's looking for the drama and the ratings and the money shot.
Because it's, you know, it's for our parents, essentially.
Yeah.
Versus something like Mindhunter or a docudrama like The Confession Tapes or something like that, where it's about immersing you in the case and you see the case and you kind of, you know, it's more about the players involved than the actual action.
Yeah.
So I feel like that's what Mindhunter does. It excels at.
Yeah. Like the actual, murders themselves in Zodiac's case to an extent, but especially in Mindhunter's case, the actual murders themselves are not at all what the show is interested in.
Yeah. Cause like going to season one, like you have that, that Pennsylvania case where the girl's killed.
Yes.
And You see hints of her body from crime scene photos. It's horrifying. It do not recommend.
Yeah.
But what makes the case fascinating is all the players involved. You've got the fiance. You've got the townspeople who know of her. You've got, I think it's her brother-in-law or whatever.
Something like that.
The couple, like one of this couple is related to the victim. And then you find out, like, and then it's through, like, the piecing together of the puzzle between Carr and Tench and Ford, where it's about a mystery. Like, it boils down to, like, it gets to the essence of, like, why do we like true crime? Because it's a mystery.
Yeah.
You know, it's not, like, this exploitative, like, look at all this great crime.
Scooby-Doo has lasted for decades.
Yeah.
People love a good old whodunit, let me tell you.
Velma was the original. true crime detective. Yeah.
Listen, I'm just saying Velma was the original Sarah Koenig, okay?
God. So I think one of the best things that season two does following season one is that it takes the whole concept of that mystery of the girl in the Pennsylvania town and basically, like, we're going to expand that. And we're going to just basically throw these guys. Like, these guys feel good because they, like, succeeded and they helped this town find this, seemingly solve this murder, mm-hmm. and whatever. And now we're going to, like, really throw it out there. Like, they use the characterization of Ford because he's kind of a cocky asshole a little bit. Like, he's a great character.
Much like the actual John Douglas.
Right. Like,
foolhardy.
And that's a great thing about, like, it really can't be overstated how good the characters are in the show and how understated the writing is. Mm. And I think, you know, the girlfriend plot in season one is probably the weakest aspect of it. Like, I get why it's there.
It's there for a reason.
Because it's all about a way to frame Holden's kind of descent into, I guess, obsession.
Yeah.
Which, again, that's a very similar theme to Zodiac, because you have Jake Gyllenhaal's
character
getting obsessed with the Zodiac Killer. And in Ford's case, he gets so obsessed that he goes and sees Ed Kemper, has a panic attack, and so he deals with the repercussions of that. And this season does a great job of continuing that because, you know, he still gets obsessed, but now he gets obsessed with solving the Atlanta murders.
Yeah.
Partially out of white guilt.
Yeah. I don't know. Do they ever, like, say that? But it's obviously there. Yeah.
Well, that's what's great about the show is that it doesn't, like, explicitly say, like, this is why he's doing this. Yeah. They don't explain the motives.
You know, like, not once does he ever look into the camera and say, like, you know, I feel really guilty about colonization.
Yeah. I would have voted for Obama for a third term. No, but it's shown through...
I would have voted for JFK.
In 30 years, keep an eye out for the 1619 project.
Listen, I just hope that some black man invents a super soaker in a few years. I'm just saying. Put that out there. You guys are doing great.
Yeah.
I love George Washington Carver. I love me some peanut butter. I'm an ally.
Love me some Jif. All right.
But I think to that point, there's just so many great scenes that emphasize that. You have probably one of the more underrated performances, which is the mom of Yusuf.
Yes.
One of the victims of the Atlanta child murders, the mother of one of the victims.
The one who's
leading.
She's
like the leader of the...
She's the leader of, like, this kind of grassroots movement to find the killer, find out what happened. And she's great.
Oh my god, yes.
She's kind of like the best character in a way.
She is definitely, I would consider her almost like, hear me out here. She's definitely like the Tywin Lannister of the season in that she gets shit done.
Yes.
And definitely people like bow to her will.
Yeah.
And
the actress who plays her, I don't know her name.
Totally
not prepared for cast listings, but
no.
She's awesome. I hope there's like a lot of Emmy feelings that I get in this.
Yeah.
I'm like, I wish, you know, Holt McElhaney gets one.
Because
I think he does a really good subtle performance.
Mm-hmm. Oh, he's always been great, but it's like this show is finally actually giving him a showcase.
Right, because in season one, he's really kind of, like, he's good.
Yeah.
But he's kind of just there to be like, Holt, this is kind of pointless, whatever. Like, he's just kind of the cynic because...
He's the Watson to the Sherlock.
Yeah, I mean, like, he definitely owns the role in season one. He's kind of the unsung hero of it. But, yeah, like, his part is just essentially, like, you know, don't do that, Holt.
And I think we discussed this off mic, but it definitely feels like the characters have a lot more agency.
Yes.
Yeah. In this season, like, there's
well,
a whole
they're actually, well, they're actually, I think, rather than shifting it into a show that's about previous crimes, making it about a show, or turning it into a show where there is an actual crime happening, it definitely gives the season a propulsion that season one didn't have.
Well,
which is not speaking ill of season one at all. It's just it has a forward momentum that the show is working towards.
Well, there's a more prevalent current crime. Like, I guess
there's
like
an actual
the first season still had BTK throughout it, but it wasn't as pressing.
Well, BTK, like, I don't think they even started investigating him yet. That's in season two.
Yeah, that's in season two.
It's just like kind of that dramatic irony.
Okay, all right.
Yeah.
But there is like that Pennsylvania crime that I'm talking about where like that's the one with the old ladies getting attacked in that other in Sacramento. If you remember that, where they're traveling around, they go to Sacramento, and there's that one cop, that one chief who's like, guys, I need help with this thing. So, like, that kind of becomes, like the episodic nature of season one, where it's like, you know, Tension and Ford go, you know, globetrotting and solve, help, you know,
it's
police
it's,
departments solve crimes.
It's a weird coming-of-age story, not for characters, but for, an agency and a science.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's... I would describe season one as a great proof of concept.
Yes.
Like, yeah. Here's the pitch. Like, this is the basics of Mindhunter, is that there's going to be cameos from, you know,
real all your favorite killers.
All your favorite killers. All of them. Speck, Kemper, mwah, the classics.
Yeah.
Over 40 hours of your
favorites. David Berkowitz! Give it up for Son of Sam!
The best of Mindhunter.
Charles Manson!
Look for it from Rhino Video.
The 80 DVD collection.
Coming to a paid programming block near you.
And we didn't edit any of it out.
And, you know, I'll always go to bat for season one because, one, Ed Kemper scenes are fucking amazing.
Oh, yeah.
I forget the actor. I'm really bad at actors' names. With this
Cameron
show.
Britton.
Cameron Britton. I knew it was Cameron something. I actually learned while watching season two that he was nominated for a guest Emmy.
Yes.
So that's cool.
Yeah.
So there's potential there for season two to get some Emmy nods, which would be great.
That would be great for the show's longevity, too.
Yes, like, because at the time of this recording, it has not been renewed.
Yeah.
So,
but also Netflix has gotten some like weird rumors in the media lately.
Oh, what's going on?
I don't know. Like, a lot of people are talking about how like Netflix is switching over to like weekly episodes instead of like binging stuff.
Well, they just said they're not going to do that. They just came out and said like, nope, it's not our model.
I've seen some rumblings here and there that people are thinking like Netflix might go out of business in the next.
I mean, Netflix
years
is $2 billion under. So,
But then again, that's how like a lot of big companies operate these days is that they log that they don't make profits so that they
like
don't
Amazon.
Pay taxes.
Yeah.
Amazon.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's also like I was listening to Abe Lincoln's Top Hat and they were talking with a guy who wrote a book about
That's
Uber
right.
and they was talking about like the new way of running companies nowadays seems to be very much just keep spending money so that you're in the public until you become part of the public consciousness because once you're part of the public consciousness the money just comes in.
Yeah.
So, like, that's what happened with Uber. It's like, but the problem is Uber is still doing that. They're still, like, leaking money. And I think that's what Netflix is doing. I think, like, Netflix has a little bit of that, like, you know, oh, if we stay in debt, people are concerned about our well-being. Sort of like what we did with the national debt before it went into the trillions. But I'm going to be honest. I don't understand Netflix's business model entirely.
Yeah.
And I'm going to say that I don't think anyone does, because they're pretty hush-hush about a lot of this stuff. They're especially very hush-hush about their viewership numbers and their finances. They're very, like, unless they'll just give out vague statements like, oh, we did well. And then it's like,
that's the weirdest thing about it is that, they never come out and be like, this show got this many viewers on in like the first week or something. So when you used to like, you know,
a show has to like literally break the streaming service for people to get an inkling that it's doing well. Like you have to have like a Luke Cage debut where like Netflix like goes down for like 6 hours or something.
Or you're just like Bird Box where just everyone talked about it for a month.
Bird Box, I would definitely believe that Uber marketing scheme there.
Well, actually, okay, so what happened with Bird Box is, Bird Box's success was a fluke of all of these different conditions coming together to create the phenomenon of a painfully average movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One, it was around Christmas time.
Yep.
Two, everyone's going home for the holidays on Christmas time. Three, everyone has Netflix. Four, they're going to turn on Netflix around with their families. Who are they going to see on the front page of Bird Box? Why, it's good old
Sandy.
It's good old Sandy B. Who doesn't like Sandy B?
And sister to Cardi B.
The answer is people who exclusively watch Crash.
Exactly. Well, there's that. And those people who were like, Miss Congeniality was just too much for me.
My name's Karen. I'm the number one fan of Crash.
Of course she would be named Karen. And of course, and it's a horror movie with a kind of, with an interesting premise. Who doesn't love that? So people around the family, around the TV say, hey guys, why don't we watch this Bird Box flick? It's an hour and a half long. It's like an hour and a half or 2 hours long. It's too short, is what I will say. And it's very inoffensive.
That's the first time I've ever heard you describe anything as too short.
They beckon their families. They say, come hither, Grandma.
You're always in the camp of, like, this could be 20 minutes shorter.
There are plenty of things that I'm like, this is too short. You didn't give this anywhere near enough time to breathe and explore your themes and whatnot. And Bird Box is a prime example of, like, there's too much going on here. You need to expand this or just drop things. And I wish they had. I actually wish they'd never made it, but that's fine. Well, okay.
Wow.
I'm glad they made it because I got a really great Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross score out of it, which is good because the movie itself did nothing with it. I've never heard such a good score get wasted.
When
by
like
a movie.
The main like conflict of the movie is that like you can't look at something.
Yeah.
You better have a damn good soundtrack to listen to.
And they didn't. They didn't. I mean, like the score is really good, but they seem to pick like the weirdest pieces for the weirdest parts of the movie. Mm-hmm. And also like the score gets really buried under the sound mix, which would be great because for a film that's all about a visual threat. Mm-hmm. You know, why are you making a movie about it if you can't see it? Mm-hmm. Movies are not what you should be doing. But it's like, okay, if you're not going to do that, maybe you should have a really great sound design so that people can hear things that you can't see. No, it is the most pedestrian sound design I've heard for a movie of that caliber. It buries the score to make room for that really pedestrian sound mix. So it's like, you committed the ultimate crime, guys. And also,
worse than the crimes of Hitler, you have wasted.
And also, it's really boring. It's really not a good movie.
I know I say this all too often, guys, but Bird Box was the perfect medium to drop Smell-O-Vision.
God damn it. So Bird Box is a little bit of an outlier because Bird Box was a success solely on a fluke. It had nothing to do with Netflix like putting money into anything.
Well,
it was just
yeah.
a series.
It mean, was like, mean famous.
I mean, they put money into making it. They put money into advertising it a little bit, enough for it to get some notice. But it was purely like word of mouth and fluke circumstances.
Well, and that's a good point to bring up how they kind of botched the advertisements for the season of Mindhunter because, one, like, we didn't know it was coming out until, like, the end of July.
Yes.
So literally a month ago, as of this recording, because we were like, when's Mindhunter season 2 coming out?
You were looking it up all the time.
I was looking it up, like, on a, if not weekly, then daily. And that's how
you were just refreshing the Netflix page.
This is part of a bigger issue with Netflix because and a subtopic, I discovered that there was a new season of the Confession Tapes released by looking up when they were coming out with Mindhunter. Not because I got an official press release from Netflix saying, hey, look, the Confession Tapes season 2. That show you watched like 7 times through. Here's season 2. Yes, it's only four episodes, so it's essentially the TV version of DLC, but here you go.
There you go.
And I was like, what the fuck? Okay, I guess I'll watch that instead.
Yeah.
And then when did they actually announce it? I think it was like the first trailer, like the teaser they did. The
first trailer was a month before it aired. And like, I want to say, like, I got so excited when the trailer came out. Not because for me to, like, the teaser. I got so excited, not because I was going to watch it, but because it was like, I get to give Taylor some really good news, and I want to be the one to send it to him.
Mm-hmm.
But then Netflix did a thing where you couldn't copy the video into something.
Oh my god.
So I was like, it was unlisted. That was the problem. It was unlisted.
God.
Until like the next day, and I was like, what the fuck? I was so, because I showed it to you later that night, but I was like, I just want to give him some good news. And then like, let it be said that every trailer that came out, I tried to send it to you.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then a week before it came out, they were like, oh, yeah, here's a trailer. Here you go.
It was a great trailer.
It was a great trailer. But, which they gave it, like, to us in, I don't know, May.
Yeah.
Or June. Like, fucking A. Like, there's And I don't even know when, like, speaking of other shows on Netflix that I watch, like, when is BoJack Horseman season 5, 6?
Six, five or six, whatever.
The next one. Yeah. When is that happening? Because I've heard about it for, like, a year now. But when is it happening?
No.
And I know we have, like, varying levels of concern about it getting a third season because, obviously, we're also in the midst of a bunch of Netflix cancellations, like Sense8, Tuca and Birdie, American Vandal, which we liked both seasons of. That's another one that's super fucking underrated.
Yeah.
Well, that's another one that kind of baffles me that they didn't renew it because it's so cheap to make.
Yeah.
Could, like, College Humor theoretically just, like, post on, like, post, like, a third season, like, on their website or something?
I actually...
Like, do they have the rights, or does, like, Netflix own the rights?
Well, Netflix owns the rights.
Netflix owns the rights because they're going to keep streaming it.
Yeah, they're going to keep streaming it.
They're not going to, like, let it expire. And
that's true.
Yeah. Like, so, look at how long they've held on to Friends. Come on.
Yeah.
Until just now.
Which, that will probably end eventually.
That ends.
Yeah, yes,
that
ends because NBC's coming out with
But as far as, like, stuff that's, like, an original of theirs, like, I can't think of one that's...
Stranger Things?
No, I'm talking about, like, where it was pitched as a Netflix original and eventually left the platform.
None.
I mean, I suppose, like, the Marvel shows have a chance of, like, having their licenses bought from Disney or something. I don't know.
They're not. Nope.
No?
No. Netflix retains them, which really sucks.
Yeah, boycott Netflix. Give us Spider-Man.
Yeah.
Fucks.
But,
for the record, fuck Disney.
Yeah, for the record, Sony was right. Sorry, guys.
Yeah.
I hate to break it to you. I'm glad that everyone was so excited about making jokes about, oh, the Xenomorph is going to be a Disney princess. Meanwhile, Disney is operating on, like, a monopoly on entertainment. Hope you guys enjoy it.
It's not a monopoly because it's not, like, 100% of the market. Blah, blah, blah. And it's like, it's 27% of the market, which is...
More than it should
more
be.
More than anything should own any industry.
Yeah. Even the company that's keeping Adam Sandler afloat deserves defending against Disney.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is Netflix.
Which, yeah, no, I guess now it is Netflix.
Yeah. So, to our one listener.
That was originally a Sony thing. Because Adam Sandler was a Sony, but now he's on the other Disney underdog.
That's right. So anyways, our one listener, if you were, like, a really big, like, Disney Spider-Man guy, I hate to break it to you, but, Disney sucks.
Yep.
And we are not okay. And that's really not cool. Anyways. Mindhunter season 2.
So,
it's so good.
It's so good. I hope we get a third season. This obviously isn't our final thoughts. We're going to talk about it more, but just to kind of end that whole little thread on Netflix and how they handle the season.
Yeah.
I have heard that Fincher is so game to, like, it's going to be 5 seasons. Like, it's the new 6 seasons of the movie.
Yeah.
It's like, it's going to happen.
Yeah.
He has clout with Netflix.
If David Fincher wants to do it, I wouldn't be, like, I can't imagine Netflix would be like...
I mean, hear me out.
Like, if Steven Spielberg wanted to do something, like wanted to do, like, 9 shows for Apple TV Plus, whatever, and Apple was like, well, sorry, you only signed on to 4, so we're just going to stick you with 4.
Yeah.
They really didn't like Ready Player One, in which they are correct.
Well, I was going to say, that's the correct opinion.
But I was going to say is that Fincher was also a producer on House of Cards.
Yes.
And that managed to get a 6th season, even though their main star was revealed to be a pedophile.
Yeah.
So... anything can happen.
Right.
Yeah. I feel like... And that one, they actually... Didn't they do something special with the last season of House of Cards? Like, they put up their own money or something like that? Or they took a pay cut or something to get it made and finish the story?
Something like that. But from what I understand, everyone who watched the last season was like...
I mean, I'm not saying that season 6 is good. I haven't watched it. I'm just saying, like, to end it where season 5 ends would be kind of shitty.
Yeah.
You know? So at least there's some fucking closure.
Yeah.
I agree. So,
well, like, sure, Kevin Spacey isn't there, but just replacing him with Andy Bernard just didn't really work out all that well. Like,
just get Christopher Plummer to come in.
They brought Cousin Oliver in. It was weird.
Yeah. Listen, the technology exists. Just replace him with Plummer. It's fine. Let's do it.
Yeah.
Let's do it. Let's win one for the Gipper, guys.
Something else I want to mention. Who is the director who did the last four episodes?
There's a guy named Carl Franklin.
Yes. Tell us about Carl Franklin, Neil.
Carl Franklin, I think he did a movie called, like, Devil in a Red Dress or something.
Yes.
Oh, Denzel?
That's Denzel,
I think that's
it?
Denzel.
Yeah.
Which
Devil in a Blue Dress was
Devil in a Blue Dress.
Denzel.
Sorry, yeah. Devil in a Red Dress.
Was that the Daniel Radcliffe movie?
That's the Asylum version.
No, that's the Woman in Black.
Woman in Black.
Sorry, Devil in Blue Dress. Sorry, Devil in a Blue Dress. That's the Denzel Washington movie. But Carl Franklin is kind of like a Netflix and HBO mainstay director. Like, if you can think of, like, a popular genre,
even just
like
premium
prestige,
cable,
or like prestige done, premium cable show.
Yeah.
Carl Franklin has worked on it.
Yep. He's worked on The Leftovers. He's worked on Homeland. He's worked on.
He has
Westworld.
Worked on Game of Thrones. If I
Game of Thrones.
Yes. Yeah. Westworld.
If
Westworld.
James Cameron's Avatar gets a TV show, he'll work on that.
That's, you know, hey man, it's fine with me. But then, so Carl Franklin. There's three directors for this season. The first three episodes are David Fincher. The next two episodes are done by a guy named Andrew Dominik, who I'm a huge fan of because he directed such films as Chopper, The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford. I said the whole title for Taylor there. Killing Them Softly with Brad Pitt back in 2012, which I saw in theaters and was like, what the fuck is this? It's magnificently directed. It's one of those movies that I'm like, when I saw it, I wasn't sure what to make of it. But I think that now that I've gotten older and now that things have changed and now especially like the economy and the world has changed, I think that movie's going to fare a lot better. But it's like, anytime Andrew Dominik just pops up, I'm like, oh shit, he's back. So when they announced, but like, it was another case of like, Netflix taking this director that I guess they felt should have done more. Cause like with season two, Andrew Stanton directed two or three episodes of season two of Stranger Things, which was awesome. It was like, man, Andrew Stanton needs to direct more things.
Yeah, because one, John Carter of Mars isn't that bad of a movie.
Speaking of Disney,
they fucked that up.
Oh, they totally did. Right. Yeah, like John Carter, because he hadn't earned
John
the
Carpenter
title
of
because
Mars.
One of the main things they fucked up was the title.
Yeah.
John Carpenter of Mars. Of the ghosts of Mars.
John Carter is not a bad movie. I wouldn't call it a good movie, necessarily. Yeah.
It's an entertaining movie. It's better than fucking Avatar.
I would call it interesting.
Yeah.
I would call it interesting.
I second Taylor's.
Yeah. I would call it interesting. I would call it, like, too ambitious for its own good.
Right. It's an ambitious failure that isn't nearly as awful as its reputation as a box office. Like, it didn't deserve to be a box office bomb.
No, it deserved to be, like, not like a big success, but like a modest success.
It deserved to have, like, one weekend on top.
Yeah, it
really
did.
I mean, granted, a modest success for that movie would be, like, $400 million.
Yeah, good point. Especially with how much money they fucking sank into it. Jesus Christ.
But also, as a giant alien dog.
How much better would it have done if, like, Taylor Kitsch was replaced by, like, somebody a bit more well-known and loved, like if it was maybe not Keanu Reeves, but like,
well, not pre John Wick,
yeah, Keanu. I don't know, like, I feel like Taylor Kitsch was
Logan Lerman,
but like, what if it was like Hugh Jackman as like John Carter or something?
Oh, that could have been interesting, yeah. I mean, like, I don't dislike Taylor Kitsch in that movie. He does fine for what he's given.
He's better in the second half than the first half.
Yeah, he is.
And I think also the script is better in the second half than the first half.
Yeah.
It's kind of a movie problem.
Yeah, it is. Like, there's some serious editing problems in that movie. There's some studio tampering going on with that movie, too. Especially because, like,
I was talking more about, like, the marketing and, like, would it have made more money if it was somebody a bit bigger.
Keep in mind, we also live in an era where the actors don't really matter. It's more about the IPs.
Yeah.
So I think part of it is John Carter is not a big thing nowadays because it's an old fucking
John Carter starring Meryl Streep.
Because it's kind of like, again, to bring up better things in our podcast, Patrick Willems' video on Robin Hood and King Arthur. They're things we know of, but they're not constant, like, they're not enough of a fixture in the public conscience to really guarantee success.
Yeah.
It, you know, he uses a comparison of Batman to those other two characters, and it's like Batman is always available, is always being, you know, readapted in some way, and is always discussed versus King Arthur, where the last movie with King Arthur was 2000. Well, there was the Guy Ritchie one. And then before that, you had, it's like every 10 years, I think Patrick mentions, it's like every 10 years he gets a new one.
It's like Pennywise.
It's like Pennywise.
Shows up again.
He's like, hey guys, some Pennywise. How's it going?
Which, do you think we'll be doing a review of It Chapter 2?
Well, I don't know, Neil. I don't want to disappoint our half listener if we don't do it.
Our half listener is Krang. He's just like,
when are you doing the review of It Chapter 2?
Yeah.
I want to hear it flow. Like slap the keyboard.
Yeah, exactly.
Would he type on the keyboard, where his body, like his robot body, would it, the robot body's like fucking fists?
Krang has like the little console, like in the stomach cavity, that would control the big hands to use the computer.
Yeah, that would.
But would he type like one finger at a time, like our parents?
Probably.
Like, yeah, that would make sense.
Tick, tick, tick.
You pleb. You utter buffoon.
There you go.
Child. You moron.
Hi, Krang, our one half listener. How you doing?
That's like the best joke I've landed here. It's great.
TBD, Neil.
TBD.
We do have October coming up, and yes, maybe we'll just wait, because we have some plans for October that will surely disappoint and not fulfill. So,
all right.
We're aiming high.
Yes. At least we're planning.
Yes.
Yes.
Planning for failure.
That's half the battle. Listen, all right.
Anyway.
Okay, what were we talking about before?
Andrew Stanton.
But yeah, Andrew Stanton, you know, did, you know, a handful of episodes of season two of Stranger Things, and I would argue they're the best directed ones.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And then, so yeah, like Andrew Dominik showing up for two episodes of Mindhunter is kind of like, what the fuck are you doing here? You should be doing something else. But also, like, holy shit, am I glad he showed up. Because, I mean, like, the Fincher-directed ones are excellent. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah, you're watching a Fincher movie.
You're watching, like, three Fincher movies right there.
The fact that he hasn't made a movie since Gone Girl is the fact that he's basically made, essentially, two movies. There's Mindhunter, the first one, and then Mindhunter, The Reawakening.
Yeah, exactly. and then the Carl Franklin ones are also very well-directed, but they don't have the same quite panache as the Fincher ones, and that's okay, because Fincher clearly has his own style that he works with. He has his own editors that he brings in, you know, because, like, those are all edited by...
Is that Roxy Music song that I'm sure he's wanted to play for decades?
Listen, I'll take anything for Roxy Music to get more exposure. Like, I've been a fan of them for a while. Funny enough, Roxy Music contained, like, the keyboardist for Roxy Music when they started out was Brian Eno, the inventor of ambient music, one of my top three musicians of all time. I never thought I'd say this, but Roxy Music got better when Brian Eno left.
I just think about that song and doing, like made-up verses, like, who ate all the potato chips? I bought them last Tuesday. Inflatable doll.
Gross.
I named her Mandy.
In every dream home, no toilet paper.
I guess I'll use paper towels again.
But with Andrew Dominik, I think Andrew Dominik's episodes strike a really great balance. Because, one, he has some wonderful shots. Like, the first shot of his run is the one shot of the cop driving while trying to get the kids to come into his car.
Yeah.
And it's just the one unbroken shot with the guy's with like the driver's face in the foreground, but like out of focus. So you
and
can't
they frame
tell.
The kid with
and they
the,
frame the kid inside the window of the car. Like, that's his opening shot. And you're like, oh shit.
Yeah.
This
and
is
he
some
does
good
some
stuff.
Good shit with, kind of almost, I don't want to say like with Anderson, but like where they're very like flat and center focused and almost like have the characters look right into the camera.
Yeah.
Specific, like the one example I would think of is when you have Tench and his wife Nancy talking about their son Brian, who at this point, spoilers, I guess we should have said spoiler warning like a while ago. Yeah. I'll just put it in the description, but we're going to probably talk about some spoilers we already kind of have.
Mm-hmm.
So their adopted son Brian, who in the first season was kind of
displays signs of
Well, in the first season he's just kind of very awkward and reserved. He doesn't really communicate.
Yeah.
At the beginning of season two, he's opened up a bit. There's a scene to establish this where they're leaving church, and he runs and plays football with some boys, and they're like, oh, wow, Brian's finally growing up. And then a couple episodes later, that's where, like you're saying, he's starting to kind of show signs of...
The signs that someone like Tench would notice in the serial killers they've studied.
Yeah, like he wets the bed. What are some other ones? Is that the only one that we really see?
That's the only really explicit one.
Yeah. So it's not even like saying, like, Brian's going to be a serial killer in season 8 of Mindhunter.
Yeah.
It's just kind of like putting that out there to make you think about it.
Yeah.
Because eventually, as we learn, Brian was a quasi-accomplice in the death of a toddler.
Yes.
Yeah.
Where,
a really upsetting.
It's very upsetting.
Toddler.
And, like... Again, it's a great way to kind of illustrate what we were talking about before about how it handles the crimes, and it still makes it very eerie without showing too much violence and goes into that exploitative quality.
Because
you literally have the local detective who's responsible for the case takes Tench into the house, which is a house for sale that Nancy, Tench's wife, who's a real estate agent, is currently put on the market. So that's why they're connected even more so. He shows them the crime scene. And, of course, they do this. This is a Fincher episode, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Fincher
does such a good job of just kind of, like, building tension from just filming people walking to a place.
Yes.
You know, the first scene of the season where you have BTK's wife just entering the house as that Roxy Music song plays.
Yeah.
And it's all just filming her and what she's looking at. And you're just like, what the fuck is behind this damn door that's moving?
It took me way too long to realize that was his wife. Like, I thought he had just broken into a woman's house and did that. But then, like, in the next, like, scene with BTK, it's, like, her buying him that book about, like, sexual deviance. It's like, oh, I guess they're just roommates now.
Moved in with my victim. Standing tall, cause my roommate's BTK.
God damn it.
But yeah, you have tension the detective walking, and you're just like, oh fuck, what's gonna happen? Cause you don't know really any details, like there was a body found, and you're like, oh fuck, okay. And then you cut to the garage where the body was, and you just have this like chalk outline of like what you think is a child on a cross, and you're just like, this is the dead body, and you're just like, fuck this, I'm leaving.
Yeah, I'm out.
There's fun. No violence, no blood, it's just, it's there, and it makes you, it basically runs thoughts through your head. Like, you start to, it's
like, they think it's a cult at first, right? They think it's some weird, like, culty people.
That's something that the detective brings, like, it might be a cult, and then potentially kind of throws it, like, blows it off, saying, like, no, they're a little bit more theatrical than this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very much so.
It's not enough fucking patchouli oil in there.
I thought for sure they were going to go down the Satanic Panic route, and I'm actually kind of glad they didn't.
Which, I wouldn't be against them doing that later.
Yeah, later, but not now.
But this is kind of a weird way to introduce it.
Yeah.
That would be, like, California.
Season 3 or 4 takes place in the 90s, and it's Holden. We're dealing with, like, Pokemon becoming
things. Satanic
Panic.
Oh, my God. That would be amazing.
Like, I would fucking love to see Mindhunter tackle that one, the trial of that, like, preschool or kindergarten.
Yes.
In California, the most expensive trial in the history of the country.
Yeah.
That would be fucking awesome.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's going to happen because that's, like, the mid-late 80s.
Well, when was Leonard Lake and Charles Ng? Because didn't Charles Ng, like, make, like, the
early
longest...
90s.
Like, the longest... like California trial until like somebody else like I think beat it, but like he just kept like firing his lawyers or something to prolong it.
Yeah Well, they just didn't know what he brought to friendship, so
But it's but this is great. The scene,
you never
the,
complain about what I bring to friendship.
But the scene is a perfect microcosm of what how well the show treats its murders and its crime scenes. You just see little, like, Tench looks through photos, and you just see little snippets of the body.
Yeah.
And it's just like, oh, so it's just enough to kind of get your imagination going.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can piece the rest of the picture together in your head.
Yes.
Like, it doesn't need to show you.
Less
is more. It's kind of the mantra of
Fill in the dots.
Right, exactly.
Connect the dots, fill in the holes, whatever,
So
it's very much like what Andrew Stanton says, you know, don't give them four, give them 2+2.
That's it, exactly.
Yeah,
yeah. So
This show is very much like that.
So
I brought it back.
But back on the topic of Carl Franklin,
yes.
It should also be mentioned he is a black director.
Yes,
and he's a man of color, which I think is very smart.
Yes.
Because
especially if you're doing the Atlanta child murders.
Because you're doing the Atlanta child murders, and to have like Whitey McWhiterson be like, "Well, I'm gonna fit him for this." It's like, no, and like, there you go. It's a great opportunity for representation.
But not only that, he's gonna know things that we just won't.
Well, and it's also like you're filming the black perspective,
right?
You know, it's a black industrial professional filming the scene of the black perspective.
Yes.
And I think that is the way to go, especially when you're kind of exploring Holden's whole perspective, too, being the white FBI agent who's trying to do his best.
Yeah.
And spoilers for kind of how it resolves, everyone's kind of feels like shit.
Yeah.
Kind of like the end of season one, except he doesn't have a panic attack. He just feels defeated.
It's the thing that I like about the end of season two. So, like, yeah, just spoilers, whatever. The thing that I like about season two is, okay, so there's this line that Ed Kemper gives earlier in the season, which is kind of the thesis statement of this season, which is, you know, basically to paraphrase, seems to me that all of your research is coming from only killers who have been caught.
Yeah, like Holden is talking to him. It's like, yeah, but like this doesn't fit the MO of, like, you know, these people. They usually have, like, they come from like a broken home and, like, you know, rough childhood, a lot of trauma. And yeah, Ed Kemper's response is like, yeah, it sounds like what you've gleaned is only from the ones who got caught.
Yeah,
you know, so like if he's really good, you know, he might never get caught. Like, he probably has a double life. He probably has, like, a normal, like, a wife, a job, you know? Like,
yeah.
Well, it really kind of plays to the whole arc of Holden where he gets too cocky, so he gets kind of his mind. He has the blinders. Like, that's also kind of a theme, is that in the beginning of the season where Ford's coming back from being hospitalized, Ted Gunn, their new boss, is like, okay, Bill, Wendy Carr, you're going to both be my blinders for Holden.
Yes.
And it's almost like that works too well. And it's kind of great. Like, it should be said that the season has such a great arc to it and everything. Like, there's so many setups and payoffs.
Yeah.
You know, from Bill's whole thing about parenthood and nature versus nurture and the fact that, like, okay, well, his child isn't his biological child. Was he born bad? Mm-hmm. Did they get a broken child, quote unquote?
Yeah.
But because are we
raising him poorly?
There's a lot. Yeah. There's a lot of like weird breadcrumbs you can kind of trace to like maybe Tench isn't like bringing his work home with him, but it does kind of come out in conversations. Like all of his neighbors are the most interested in him when he's talking about work and these serial killers and these, like, you know, dark things that his work is involved with.
Well, not only that, but I mean, like, it also works for expanding Tench as a character as well, because Tench has been very much like very dismissive of these people, whereas Holden is very much like accepting of them. And now Tench is having to kind of come with the realization that these are people too, when, you know, he starts seeing these things exhibited in his son, you know, like he wants to keep it away from home, but it is home.
Yeah.
Like, whether he likes it or not.
You know.
So it's forcing him to expand his mind view a little bit. And whether he actually does or not is an entirely different point. You know, we'll see if there's a season three, how that affects him. But, like, I think that he's probably the one that goes through the most growth in this season.
And hopefully we get at least three seasons, because it definitely seems like, of the three main characters of Holden Ford, Bill Tench, and Wendy Carr, Holden was the main character of season one.
Yeah.
And, like, he got the most stuff. That's where the whole girlfriend subplot kind of comes into play.
His life changed the most. You know, he went from like this rookie, kind of green, inexperienced in both like love and career, to having both, and then kind of losing his love and his career, kind of, you know, like having the panic attack and whatnot, kind of.
And then, on
hold. So that's a big change, whereas Tench was a pretty constant character for most of it, from what
he
I remember.
Yeah, he was just kind of supposed to be the foil.
Yeah, he was. He's the Captain America to Holden's, like Iron Man.
Yeah, that's fair.
Like, Iron Man's like the more dynamic character, and Captain America's the steadfast.
Yeah, that's legit. Yeah.
And then season two, Bill goes through all of that.
Yeah.
Holden's kind of has an arc, too, because you still have his kind of cocksure.
Yeah.
Like, he's just focused. He's got to solve these murders. I have, like, he always talks about, I have this profile in mind for the killer of these kids.
Yeah.
It's all one killer.
He's stubborn.
He's very stubborn because, one, he wants to be right.
Mm-hmm.
Two, he wants to solve it.
Yes.
You know, he wants to do that for the mothers, for the families of the victims, for the kids. You know, and, you know, that ends up being pretty poignant at the end.
Yes.
But, and I hope we get a season three and we get some good stuff with Wendy Carr.
Yeah.
Because Wendy, like, Anna Torv is fucking awesome.
Yes.
She is,
I actually don't dislike any of her subplots through either season.
No, I don't either.
They're just kind of nice little asides. They're clearly there to kind of, you know, give you a little respite in between all the murder stuff.
Yeah.
And they do some good, some cool shit, because they introduce the whole idea of her going on interviews.
Yeah.
She talks to, what's his, Junior is what he wants to be called.
Elmer. Wayne Henley? Elmer Wayne Henley.
Yes. Who is
Dean Corll's, like, henchman.
And who's Dean Corll?
Dean Corll was this gross, like, pedophile guy that would, like, lure kids in with, like, booze and partying. And he's like, hey, you can, like, party at my house. I'm the adult that's cool. And, but, like, his little henchman, Elmer Henley, would, like, kind of lure these kids in. And
he was, like, Igor.
He would molest them and kill them and stuff. Yeah, torture them, kill them.
Really fantastically awful ways. It's one of the few true crime stories where I've listened to, like, what, like, how Dean Corll tortured these kids, and I'm just like, I'm out.
Yeah.
I'm done.
For me, that was Albert Fish.
Yeah, Albert Fish is another one of those. It's just truly fucked. Dean Corll would strap them to a board.
Yeah.
And then torture them that way, which is, and, like, apparently he had one in his van that he would, it was just kind of like his mobile torture, like, his mobile torture van. It was really fucked. They go and interview Elmer Wayne Henley Jr., which was a surprising, like, but, like, good cameo there.
I hadn't, like, expected that, but then again, I forgot that Dean Corll, like, was killed.
But also, Dean Corll, funny enough, is the only one that suffered the least, sort of.
I guess, yeah.
He did. I mean, like,
he got off easy.
He got off easiest.
But
the guy that they got to play Henley is looks so much like the actual.
Is there
guy.
Like a casting Emmy?
You could say that about all the killers. And
what's the thing? Honestly. Like, is there a casting Emmy? Because goddamn, the show deserves all of them. Because Cameron Bright, fucking awesome.
Yeah.
The guy that got to play Manson, who apparently plays him in Once Upon a Time in America.
He's also in Hollywood. He's also in Justified, apparently.
He's in Justified. That's right.
Yeah.
The guy who plays WW, what was his initials, end of season two, Atlanta child murder guy.
Wayne Wilson.
Thank you.
Looks
strikingly like him. What was the other one? David Berkowitz guy.
David Berkowitz probably, like, so there was makeup involved, but
there was.
Yeah. That's good makeup.
Well, I mean, like, that was like it was like I told you guys, you know, when I first saw the makeup, I was a little like, I kind of knew that it was, but I was still like, oh boy, I was very struck by it.
Yeah.
And then I realized that, like, it was kind of off-putting looking to me. I was like, I don't know. But then I remembered, like, Oh, wait. David Berkowitz himself, when he was younger, had, like, he hadn't grown into his face. Yeah. Like, it looked very weird.
He has a weird, like, meat face.
Yeah. Like, it's
he
only...
He has a face that kind of looked like it was kind of weirdly proportioned, like a weird side of beef.
It's only when he got older that he grew into his face. But when he was young, it was like, oh, I don't know. Sort of like some people just look better as they get older. Yeah. And Berkowitz was one of those cases. So, in terms of getting the kind of off-putting nature of his face... They nailed it.
Yeah.
So it's really fucking impressive. I was really impressed by the roster that they had for interviews this season.
I guess we should talk about Manson a little bit, at least.
Yeah,
we got to talk about Manson a little bit. I would argue that's probably the best interview of the season.
Yeah.
Because of, like, I mean, like, all the interviews kind of go one way. I mean, like, the thing that I love about the interviews in the show is that they're very much played, like, they're very much, like big climax actions.
They're the set pieces.
Set pieces, but, like, it's just people sitting and talking. But they feel so intense. And, like, you kind of get in with the characters a little bit as well as they're interviewing, because you're kind of like, are they going to say the right thing? Or are they going to fuck this up? Oh, shit, I want
to
know.
Yeah, if you want to learn more about how to build tension through, like, cinematography, editing, and dialogue, watch Mindhunter.
Watch the interview scenes.
Mindhunter, and, I mean, I guess speaking of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, like, Tarantino is really good with
stuff, too.
Yeah, watch the bar scene from Inglourious Basterds.
Yes.
But, yeah, watch Mindhunter, because it's so good at that.
Yeah. If you ever want to learn how to make shot reverse shot interesting, watch Mindhunter. Yeah.
Who was the guy that, like, immediately stopped the interview at once he kind of... gave enough or gave as much as he wanted to?
Oh, goodness, I can't remember his name. I think he was the one that there were a couple people that I was not familiar with. Like,
he was the New York killer guy.
He was the
bag killer.
Yeah.
Or no, they were looking for the bag killer.
Yeah.
But they asked him about it.
Yeah. Well, he was interesting because the actual guy actually showed up in The Exorcist.
Yeah.
Like, he was a lab technician and William Friedkin needed someone for that shot, for a scene. Mm-hmm. And he was like, hey, this is actually your job. Come do this. So he's in The Exorcist. The real guy is in The Exorcist. I've seen that scene.
He was the gay one.
Yes. And he was one...
And he targeted...
And he was in SM.
SM. To the point where...
SM.
Well, it's S&M.
Well, it's S&M,
but there was another, like, it's another interesting thing.
It's not sadomasochism.
Yeah.
It's sadomasochism.
Well, it's like, but that's the thing that's interesting.
You fucking pleb.
You child.
Greg, actually Ford.
But that's the thing that's so interesting about that moment with Greg. It's like, oh, did we just learn a little bit more about Greg?
Yeah.
Oh.
Well, you know, homosexuality is a deviancy.
God damn it, no.
I'm so glad you came up with that totally not real story about having a female lover car. Cheers.
Greg.
Welcome to Reagan's America. Like the 80s were like the height of the gay panic. So.
Yep, very much so. I was going to say, funny enough, with that one killer we were talking about, Friedkin was apparently, like, so, like, interested that, like, oh, I actually, like, filmed this guy. He went and made this movie called Cruisin', which is about a cop going undercover into the gay S&M club scene.
Is that the one with Pacino?
Pacino.
Yeah!
It is very controversial and has not aged well at all.
It is not.
And it is, like, I think it's, like, been partially banned.
Do they eat the poo-poo?
No, but there's a scene...
Let me know! But I want to get into your ass!
But there's a scene in John Benjamin Has a Van where he turns into, like, a were-Jew or something, where he, like, gets bitten by, like, a rabbi or something, and at night he becomes a rabbi, and there's a scene where he goes into, like, a gay rabbi's club, and all the things that are happening in there are actually, like, a parody of things that happen in Cruisin', which is, the most in-depth, like obscure reference to do, but like once you catch, like, it's funny on its own, but once you catch it, it's even funnier, which is what the good sign of any reference humor. It has to be funny on its own.
And, I mean, that's, you just described like all the good seasons of Simpsons.
Hell yeah, my dude.
I'm just saying, give me some baby oil and that mesh crop top. I'm going in.
Like, you watch like nine seasons of, like, the first nine seasons of Simpsons, then watch Citizen Kane. You'll appreciate Simpsons so much more when you realize Mr. Burns is just a constant Citizen Kane reference.
He really, exactly. So yeah, Charles Manson. We got to talk about him. That episode is fucking great because that's another Andrew Dominik one. I was gonna say the reason why I like Andrew Dominik, like just finishing up on that point, the reason why I like Andrew Dominik so much is one, he has a great visual style that isn't quite David Fincher's, but you could see them being like brothers. You could see them being like Ken Burns and Rick Burns. But like also. David Fincher is very fast in his pacing, especially in the dialogue. But, like, there were a couple of parts in season two where I was like, I love David Fincher's pacing, but if I showed this to my girlfriend, Emily, you know, I could see her maybe being put off by it a little bit. Just because, like, it's not something that she's used to, I guess. But the Andrew Dominik episodes have their own pacing, which is fast, but it allows things to breathe, which is why his episodes are, like, 15... sometimes 20 minutes longer than the other ones, because he just allows things to breathe a little bit more. And that works super well for Mindhunter. So I think that Carl Franklin might be the weakest of the directors, but that's not a criticism by any means. That is just like in terms of what he's got going on. Like each of the directors bring their own things to it, but Carl Franklin is just a little bit more of like a TV director, whereas these other guys are very clearly like film directors. So like once again, like Carl Franklin's episodes are wonderful. Like I don't want to sound like I'm shitting on Carl Franklin.
No, shitting on Carl Franklin.
No,
I mean if this is your roster of directors, you would still pick Carl Franklin for the more Atlanta focus.
He's the one I wanted for exactly. That. He is the one like of those three. Like I'm the happiest that he's the one who covered them. But once again, Carl Franklin does a really good job of adapting to Fincher's style. He doesn't he's not quite doing it, which is fine. I don't want him to, but he does it enough to where it doesn't feel out of place.
Yeah.
And that's a magnificent thing. It's not quite as hard of a turn as like say House of Cards.
Yeah.
Season 1, where like the first two episodes are very much David Fincher, and then after that they're directed by other people and you can kind of tell. Like they don't have that same quality to it. Anyways, Charles Manson, another Andrew Dominik episode. That one's great because once again, like all of the interview scenes have their own kind of rhythm. They have their own kind of cinematography that they go for. And the Charles Manson one is the one where things go off the rails. It's the one where they change things up. It's the one where the interview doesn't quite go as planned, aside from the Elmer Wayne Henley Jr. one.
What was the interview before Manson?
There's
the two that they did in Atlanta.
Yes.
With Barney.
Yeah.
I forget what his name is, but he's a guy that loves the sweets. And he's a guy that speaks seven languages, but forgets to name English.
That's because his IQ was actually, like borderline.
Or something. Retardation.
It was borderline retardation. Yeah, he just liked to put on airs, but, like, his actual IQ was, like, borderline developmental.
He's the kind of guy that would say strategery.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, that fucking scene is great.
Yes.
That's a scene out of a Coen Brothers
movie. Yes, very much so.
So if you like offbeat characters...
Well, that and the other guy...
The other guy, yeah.
Like, who, like, sent the ransom note, like, after he killed the person.
Yes.
Yeah.
Who, like, and, like, he totally believed... Like, he's a real guy, apparently. He's a real murderer. It was a real case. But, like, he genuinely... Like, he thought that he was, like... 12 steps ahead of the police when
playing
actually
six-dimensional chess.
When actually he was, he was like his own worst enemy because he was just not smart.
Yeah,
I love it.
I remember there being like another big wig. Maybe I'm thinking of like Berkowitz or something, but I just remember thinking like the previous interview was just so hard to top. And then the Manson one happened, and I was blown away. And the Manson one comes, I mean, really, like, if you had to name, like, an apex of the season, it's the Manson interview. because, or at least in my opinion, because, like, God, that episode is so great because, you know, you have all the Atlanta politics going on and, like, you know, you have, like, the black community in Atlanta is talking about, like, you know, it's got to be the KKK that's, like, making all these kids disappear, right? Who else would do that?
Yeah, that's a whole other dynamic to it.
You know,
it's such a shade of gray, too, because you're like, well, like, I get why they think that.
Right.
But we can't be too, like, myopic and think that, you know, because it's the whole thing, like, of the so-and-so wouldn't do this to their own community.
Yeah.
That's the whole thing. So.
But, like, that's Holden's profile for, because serial killers rarely go outside their own race. And but, like, there's all of that talk. And then, like, the politics. And, like, as soon as, like, was it the commissioner or the mayor, like, found out
the
that
commissioner.
That's what the profile was, that they kind of dropped it, which...
And they kick out the FBI, like, you're gone.
Like, I mean, and not to, like, bring, like, too much, like, real-world politics into this, but, like, I remember, like, talking to my dad about how, like, he kind of complained about how, like, I guess, like, Obama was very, very hesitant about using the phrase, like, radical Islam mm-hmm. when it came to, like, some of these terrorist actions. And, yeah. like... Obama came out like later or like in another interview or something like a day or two later. He's like, look, I'm not going to say it. I'm not going to put that out there because it's just going to put a target on a lot of like people's back and whatnot. Oh, yeah. And it's like when you're in a position like that, you know, like your words have power and you can incite some stuff.
Yeah. If you ever want to have a bad time, ask a Muslim American or even just like, yeah. like a Muslim immigrant, about what their lives were like pre and post 9/11.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
If you ever want to just have a real bad time. Yeah. And that's one of those things where it's just like, if you throw that out there, you're just going to make life complicated for a lot of people.
Yeah, duh, Neil, they all celebrated when the towers went down. I saw it.
I saw it in a bar.
I put it on MySpace.
But yeah, so
like, my life journal.
Like in that episode, they have like these like throwaway lines from like the mother from the activist group that talks about how like half of the Atlanta PD cops were like former KKK members. You have that. You have the politics of like, you know, putting out that profile would probably put a target on a lot of people's back, and then so you have all of that, and then they talk about the Manson killers, like the Manson hippies, how they tried to frame the Black Panther Party because Manson was all about starting a race war.
Helter Skelter, so, motherfucker.
So you have all of this, and then they somehow also weave it in to Bill Tench's relationship with his son and the yeah. theme of family.
Yeah.
And just like all of that just intertwines and connects in that Manson interview where the guy playing Manson really nails it. And again, that also we've talked about it, it's a masterclass and just like blocking.
Yes.
Yeah, you know,
he's a really short guy, but he like sits on the back of the chair, so he's looking down on everybody, so he has the power.
Yeah. Well, it's great, too,
because he's very manipulative.
Because that, but also, no other interview to that point is filmed like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, even Ed Kemper, who is 6'9 or whatever.
Yeah, I think he's 6'9.
He has never filmed towering over anybody. It's That's always true, below yeah. him. So he's on
the
same
level. They were, like, on the same level.
They're always on the same level.
And that was a deliberate
Every
choice.
Interview, Berkowitz, Elmer Wayne, yeah. all on the same level.
Which is to show a level of control in the yes. in the interviews, but also to show the relationship between, where, like, and the trust.
Yeah,
right.
yeah the trust,
that they're both
exactly.
They're at eye level. Like, you know, they're both the same here. Like, you know, and that's
Pizza,
great.
Pizza, you guys.
Yeah.
Big yeah. fan.
Yeah. But then you have the Charles Manson episode, which, like, all the blocking kind of goes out the window. Like all the traditional blocking of that goes out the window because they don't have the control in this anymore. It is all entirely Charles Manson.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of different dynamics going on with Charles Manson in that one as well. Because Holden is clearly kind of a fangirl. Mm-hmm. Tench clearly despises him and... Charles Manson is there, one, to do his own thing, but two, also to try to push for, like, peddle the narrative that he was taken advantage of and he had nothing to do with, mm. which is great because in the same episode they include Holden's interview with Tex.
Yeah.
Yes.
The guy who famously, or I should say infamously, led the attack on the Sharon Tate household.
Mm-hmm.
who has gotten clean, you know, has kind of turned his life around a little bit and found Jesus. But him basically dispelling everything that Manson said. Like, you know, it's easy for Ford to get wrapped up in, you know, and enamored with Manson, but to have Tex there just be like, no, he's playing you.
Well, that's what's great about the two of them is that I think they enhance both. Mm-hmm. Like, if you take both, if you separate them too much, it's like they're still really good, but they're great companion piece scenes.
Yeah.
Because you're basically hearing two sides of the story. And as I believe we've discussed off mic, if you listen to the Tex interview, and it's being filmed in like kind of like a mess hall.
Yes.
Yeah. And you just hear these like ambient noises of people screaming.
Yes.
And loud noises, and you're just fuck is this?
Yeah.
Then they're like flashbacks or what do you call it if it's an audio version of a flashback?
Well, it's just like little nuggets that like you don't know what you're listening to.
Yeah.
Like you don't know if it is like, oh, it's like Tex talks about like killing the, you know, the victims of the Tate murders.
Yeah.
So it's like, is that part of that, or is that something in the background? Is that a prisoner? Is whatever. And so you're kind of in this weird headspace, and it gives a really eerie, poignant feel to that interview too.
Yeah. And that's kind of why I make the case that I think the Andrew Dominik episodes might be my favorites of the season, because he's clearly bringing his own thing into it. And, like, I couldn't tell you for sure if Fincher would have done that.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, like, Fincher is my favorite director of the three of them. But, like, just little stuff like that, you know, I don't know if Fincher would have done that.
Well, and then you have, like each director does great things within their episodes that make it kind of, like, make them stand out amongst the three.
Yes.
Like, because Carl Franklin also has, like, you know, the town hall meeting with the mayor. That's a great fucking scene.
Yes.
You have the march scene where Ford is trying to move this cross through the streets of Atlanta to get to this church, which when we watched it, we're like, oh, fucking no, because it's a white man.
Yeah.
Trespassing on a black march with a cross.
Yep.
Yeah.
And we were just like, what's... No. Nothing happened to that extent, but it is like, there is that like tension to it. Like, oh, fuck, what's happening?
Yep.
And then all the...
The optics on this are really bad.
All the, like, the whole sequence of them, like, waiting at the bridges, listening for a body to drop. Like,
oh, that's just... with the Gary Numan song.
The Gary Numan song. It's fucking... It's like, I dare say it's masterful.
Yeah.
Because it's great tension. It reminds me of Zodiac.
Yes.
Yeah. A lot. And, you know, then you have the whole comments like, I heard a splash. Because that's what they're listening to.
Yeah.
They're listening for a body hitting the water so they can catch the Atlanta murderer in the act of dumping the body. And seemingly, they do. So,
yeah.
Is there, okay, as we wrap this up, is there any negatives that we have on the season?
I do kind of wish that Anna Torv's character, Wendy?
Yes.
Wendy Carr, yes.
I do kind of wish her, I know I was kind of, I griped a bit about in season one with, like, Holden's relationship, like, it was connected to what was going on, but it kind of just felt like I was watching a different show whenever it was focusing on them sometimes.
Yeah.
I feel like... I mean, I liked the Anna Torv stuff in season two more than the season one Holden relationship.
Yeah.
But it also just kind of felt like this just side thing that... I don't know. It's just like, well, here's some context of, like, the 80s, but it doesn't have much to go... Like, it doesn't have... I guess, like, her partner is, like, challenging her about, you know, like, what role she wants to play in her line of work now. Like, so she's pushing her. So.
It's definitely the most subtle thing.
Yeah, it's a bit more subtle.
Because, like we talked about before, I hope it's build up to her greater arc in season three.
Yeah.
The hypothetical season three. Because it is relevant. It's just... Because it is about... Her whole arc up to this point is her kind of coming out of her shell because she basically left a relationship and a job in season one. Started a whole new life. So there's like subtle kind of abstract scenes in season one that's about that. Like her with a tuna can.
Right, yeah.
You know, feeding the cat and stuff like that. And then you have this season where they it's a bit more concrete. You have her... in you know, more open relationship, out in the open, and but then that comes crashing down when basically you learn that her lover is like still hiding their relationship from her estranged family.
Yeah, the things that she's criticizing her for not being more open about are things that she's still not being open about.
Yeah.
And yeah, just kind of living, like, she's basically just lying to other people about what she's really doing,
right,
you know, in a bit of a hypocritical way. I mean, like, I still feel bad for the way Wendy handled that, but also, like, I think that it's very in character for the way that Wendy
handled it. Well, it's also, like, it's a great human moment because it's like, yeah, maybe it's not handled in the best way, but it's so understandable why she would handle
it. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. No, that's the thing. It's like, yeah, I understand why she felt the way she did, why she reacted the way she did.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's not bad. I think I was less interested in that stuff, but it's not really like a, that's me kind of looking for a problem, honestly. Greg just kind of disappeared after a few episodes. And
he was sent to get coffee by Ted Gunn, and then he faded from existence.
Which, that's fine, because Greg has kind of... I'm okay with that.
I honestly forgot he was, like, the fourth member when season two started.
Yeah.
It's been two damn years.
Well, it's because... That's true.
Yeah.
Well, it's because Greg, you know, showed his real usefulness, which was not terribly.
Yeah.
And he seems to be kind of at odds, like, kind of, like... He kind of scrapes rather than jives with the rest of the team. And, you know, also they don't really trust him because he's the one who ratted them out.
Yeah.
Which hopefully that's something that pays off later.
Yeah, I hope they do more with it because right now he's just, like, really all he is just the least interesting character.
Yeah.
And I wish either he was more interesting or if he was just let go or something. Like,
well, I mean, he does have the best seat in the show. He's like, hey, kids. You want to come do some errands for me? You
show
cop,
us your dick.
Show us your dick, cop.
Yeah.
If you're a cop, you show us your dick.
Yeah, that's the best. That's the best. That is the best.
Like, he comes out, what are you doing to those kids? They ain't doing nothing. What?
Yeah, that is the best part in there.
Well, I feel like Greg's purpose is more to kind of generate conflict.
Yeah.
And which I mean, it's kind of up for debate, I guess, if that's a bad thing or a good thing. Obviously he's there, like, in the Elmer Wayne scene.
Yes.
To kind of set up Wendy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, you know, because she needs to go there with somebody. So there has to be four people.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure.
So,
for sure.
And they do kind of a nice little fake out where it's like, oh, Greg really wants to prove that he can do it. So he's all.
Well, like, but couldn't they, like, I mean, devil's advocate, couldn't, like, Holden have done, like, an interview with, like, Barney, and then, like, Holt had, like, stayed and kind of did an interview with Wendy.
You mean Tench?
Yeah, that's what I meant, sorry. Yeah, Holt McElhaney. Or,
yes, but you have the whole dynamic of Holden and Tench.
Right.
And I think that's just so solid that I think you would lose something. Because Tench hasn't really done it with anyone else.
No, he's really
Holden
not.
Obviously has, like you mentioned, Barney.
Yeah.
Well, also in terms of not necessarily superiority or like hierarchy, but in terms of like experience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's not something that Wendy is used to doing. So if she went on one with Tench, Tench is going to naturally take control of that one. And Wendy's just kind of... Wendy would kind of essentially just be there to be there. Like, she wouldn't really be there to serve a huge purpose. The reason that it's good that she did it with Greg is because Greg just really drops the ball, so she has to show up and save it, which means she's kind of putting herself out there to save the interview.
Yes.
Like, if she was not in a situation where she had to save it, if she was with someone who was, like, it was smooth sailing with, she wouldn't have done that. You wouldn't get the same thing. So you have to put her in that situation.
What if? And yes. I'm not going to say
no.
I'm not going to say that this is like automatically makes it better.
Uh-huh.
But what if Wendy was the third interviewer during the Manson scene? You have Holden fangirling out over Manson. You have Holt losing his cool, and then you have Wendy saving the day over those two. Would that be interesting? Because, like, I mean, I get what Neil's saying. I think that's a really good point, that, like, Greg is kind of there to, as a way to be the stepping stone for Wendy to advance her
character.
Because that's all he's good for. A human
foot stool. But if that's all he's... If that's all he is...
in the SM, so maybe he is a human footstool.
Listen, hey.
I mean, like, that's a purpose, and I'll give you that. That's a really good argument, but if that's all he is
I could chalk that up to some weaker writing, where it's like you... Ideally, like, you want to have a character that serves both plot and, like, flavor.
Right.
Whereas, like, because, you know, if you have people that just are there to serve the plot, you get Jessica Jones season one, where everyone there is just, like, all the characters are pretty, like, aside...
Or you get something like Aaron from from The Office.
Yeah.
Who's literally just there to be, like, someone's girlfriend at a given time.
Yeah. Exactly. But, like, you know, the characters in season one of Jessica Jones that aren't named Jessica Jones or, you know, the Purple Man, they're all kind of light. And
Neil, you're one of the few people to refer to him as the Purple Man, and I'm proud of you.
Well, because that's how I got you to know who he was.
I knew who he was. I knew he was Purple Man.
Well, when I kept saying Kilgrave, you were like, who? Yeah. And then I was like, the Purple Man. You're like, oh, that's the Purple. Oh.
Yeah.
But what I was going at is, like... Like, a number of the characters in Jessica Jones season one just seem to be there to serve a plot purpose later on. It's not until, like, a certain episode until they finally get there and you're like, oh, that's why you're there. Okay, never mind. And then they just kind of disappear.
Yeah.
Greg is not quite like that. I mean, like, Greg is still there. Like, he still serves a purpose. Mm-hmm. But I could argue that it's maybe not some of the best writing for Greg.
Yeah.
It's not bad. I'm just going to say
also,
it's not.
Also, isn't as harmful because he's, like... the fifth most important character.
I know. Again, like... For the most part, I'm very, very positive on this show. I'm just really, like... When you say, is there any negatives, this is just me looking for interesting airtime and conversation. Like, me playing devil's advocate, honestly.
And to your theory of Anna Torv being in the Manson thing, I feel like that would kind of defeat the purpose of the Manson interview. To have someone actually succeed in that interview.
Yeah.
Because it's Manson. Okay. Like, the whole point is that he's like a force of nature.
That's true.
And that they walk away from it basically not getting anything except, you know.
Well, that's me trying to find a way to write Greg out of the show. Work without Greg? Like, is there
what
a way?
If Greg was murdered by Manson.
That's me trying to answer the question, is Greg pointless? Like,
which, no. That shot where he's in the background getting coffee while they talk about not inviting Greg to the fucking FBI party.
Greg, can you get coffee? And the second he's gone, okay, I'm inviting all of you to my party.
Yeah.
All right, all three of you are coming. Not Greg, though. Fuck Greg. And then Greg's like, excuse me, I heard my name? And he's like, no, you didn't.
Okay, shut the fuck up.
Shut the fuck up, Greg. Two sugars. So... Okay, yeah. So
that was my my very picky nit.
Yeah.
Any picky nits for you, Neil? Any flaws?
Nothing that Steven hadn't already said. I mean, like, I kind of like I enjoyed Wendy's. Yeah, the same thing that Steven said. Like, I enjoyed Wendy's relationship stuff more than I enjoyed Holden's relationship stuff in the first season.
Yes.
I kind of wish it was a little more tied in. It kind of felt like at some times they were just. It was a case of giving Wendy something to do.
Yeah.
Which is not stellar, but that's okay. But, like, even then, like, it still played out way better
than it
could
have. Even though those scenes are pretty great, like, the bowling scenes.
Yeah, good. What I was going to say is, like, those scenes still played out way better than I thought they would.
Yeah.
So, like me saying that something to do sounds a lot more derogatory than it's actually meant to be. I think Greg, I still think the show needs to figure out a little bit more of what they want to do with Greg. But other than that, I don't really have that many... Mm-hmm.
Well, I feel like with Wendy's case, it's more like her development is still kind of more emotional.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. and so it doesn't feel as...
She's the Vulcan of the show.
Yeah. Well,
she's, like,
it just
learning emotions.
It just doesn't... Like, there's not as much, as we mentioned, propulsion to the season. So in the other subplots going on, there's not as much propulsion in that one
that's
compared
true.
To the others.
That's a good point,
Because I feel like it's building towards something.
Yeah.
That's what I hope it is.
Yeah.
Because it's more about her emotional journey still.
Yeah.
Versus, like, okay, Holden's had his emotional journey. Bill Tench is going and has a whole one in the season.
Yeah.
And Wendy's kind of like the long con. where, you know, we have her isolation, we have her feeling her loneliness, we have her kind of jumping headfirst into a new life, and then when we get the Elmer Wayne interview, then we get kind of that hint of something more, which is like, oh, so she's kind of building that confidence, she can go do interviews, she can do her job better, and that's cool, which is kind of in, like, integrated into the romantic relationship.
Yeah.
A little bit. So it's not like, so it is tied in that way. Like, it could be tied in more, but it is at least relevant. So,
yeah.
Apparently, like, I'm honestly kind of thinking about any flaws. Like, other than that, like, the only complaint, the only way I could really say it with, like, the Wendy subplot is just like, it's like, okay, well, it's just not, like, A++ like the rest of the season. It's just an A-. It's a B+.
It's the B on the report card.
It's
good.
I would agree. Okay, if we've got that, then I'm going to pose this question. What do you guys want to see in season 3?
O.J. Simpson trial.
Al-Qaeda.
Done. Time travel.
SEAL Team 6.
Holden finds Jack the Ripper.
I was gonna say I think that I like that what they did with this season, which is, you know, putting in an actual case, which, like, it gives the season a momentum. I wonder if they're going to continue that with the third season. I'm thinking that with the third season, they're going to do the Green River Killer.
Yes.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
Gary Ridgway. Because, one, that is one that they actually did, and they were actually very heavily involved with. Two, I mean, it's probably, like, I think Gary Ridgway, aside from maybe, like, there's a few killers that have been brought to light now recently that... have some pretty high numbers on there.
They boast high numbers or something?
They boast high numbers, but one of them, I think he's gotten up to like 100, and they're like, this guy could be legit. I don't know that much about him yet, but I'm keeping an eye on it, but there is a possibility that if this is true, he is the highest, like, he has the highest body count if it's an American serial killer.
But for a long time, it was Gary Ridgway.
Like, to this day, I think it is still Gary Ridgway.
Well, there's, like, definitely some where, like, oh, it could be so-and-so, but it's more like speculation, like that killer nurse guy who euthanized his patients. Mm. Like, he could have done that to hundreds of people.
Exactly.
Or, like, Kermit Gosnell, who, how many babies did he abort? How many mothers did he kill? Like, who knows?
Exactly.
Nobody... We know this much, and it's just kind of the tip of the iceberg.
It's all speculation. But, like, Gary Ridgway, I think, to this point, still holds the record. So I'm thinking they're probably going to go with Green River because, yeah, that's like, that's a case. That's a case, like a capital C case. But it was also the one where they had to coordinate with Ted Bundy on it.
Yes.
Which is where the relationship in Silence of the Lambs was inspired by. It was Ted Bundy helping with the Green River Killer.
Yep. Wow.
That would be, if they're smart, that'll be a really good third season because it's an escalation, but also, like, a solidifying, like, what the show can do. And that's everything that you want a third season to do.
What was Ted, like, what time frame was Ted Bundy again?
70s
and 80s. 70s and 80s.
That was 70, okay. So
yeah, he was in prison at that point.
Yeah, he was in prison in the 80s. Like, he was executed in late 80s?
Late 80s, early 90s.
Early 90s, yeah.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, that would fit. I asked because I was kind of curious if, like, oh, like, well, if Fincher plans on doing 5 seasons, would he...
Yeah,
that maybe in a later season, or does the timing kind of work out for that one to be the third season?
Yeah, that works out with Green River Killer, right? When does that take place?
It's in the '80s,
like mid-eighties,
I think.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of who were the hitchhiker kill, like the ones who would kill like hitchhikers all the time. Like the serial killers that would like pick up hitchhikers and kill them. Like if
the
that
Hillside was, Stranglers?
What now?
Was it the Hillside Stranglers?
Because they were 70s.
Yeah,
they were the 70s. That's right.
I'd have to like look at my phone and like go through like last podcast.
When there's like stuff like episodes. What was Dahmer? Like, was Dahmer the 80s? Or was he 90s?
Dahmer was the 80s.
Yeah, so like Dahmer's like potential Dahmer, there. Huh? But yeah,
when was John Wayne Gacy?
Gacy was the 70s.
Yeah.
Mm.
But, I mean, like, they could interview him in the 80s, because they interviewed a lot of people. And then my question becomes, do they want to, like, how closely do they want to hew to history?
Mm-hmm.
So, is there people that they want to interview outside of, like, what was in the books? Mm-hmm. But then...
Well, you brought up a good point, because we discussed this off mic as well.
Yeah.
Is Wendy getting involved more with the Green River Killer because the victims are women?
So, yes.
Like, so that's a whole angle, yeah. too. So... And it'd be a good opportunity to hire female directors to film stuff like that.
I would love to see more of that. Like, I'd love to see them throw, like, Amy Simons in there.
Amy Simons, fucking get Patty Jenkins to do an episode. She did Monster.
Maybe so. Well, that depends on if her, like, workflow is the same as what they've got going on there, too.
Right. I mean, she's done with Wonder Woman, so.
Catherine Bigelow.
Shit, man. That could be interesting.
Other female directors that we don't know because we suck.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, like, I think Amy Simons is the one that I think they would probably... Sophia they're most likely to
Coppola.
No.
but that's... Elizabeth Banks. Director of Pitch Perfect and Charlie's Angels. Elizabeth Banks.
Stop this.
Yeah,
stop
I can tell from thing. That new trailer it's better than the old ones.
It probably is.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, like, I'm still not, like, I'm still probably not going to see it, but I said, when we saw it initially, I was just like, I can safely say this is just not for me. Not that it looks bad, it's just I'm glad
there's less male gaze.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, great. For sure.
I think the Cameron Diaz, like, Drew Barrymore, like, Lucy Liu, Charlie's Angels movie is one that, like, if I see it on TV, I might be like, oh, I remember this. Huh? It's probably one of those movies that, like, it's not as good as you remember.
it wasn't as good as you remembered it.
I remember being entertained by it, but then again, I was, what, 9 or 10 when that movie came out?
The first one is...
I was right at that age where, like, I would have had a crush on Cameron Diaz, probably.
I will say the first one is entertaining, but it's really dumb. The second one is just bad.
I did not see the second one.
Yeah. It is. The second one is hard to stomach. It's so bad. But,
Full Throttle, more like Full Throttle, a fucking bullet into my goddamn face. Pull that trigger, daddy.
Oh my god. So, anyways, I was just throwing that out there to, you know, to see if anyone had any thoughts about, like, what
I was thinking Bundy.
You mean Mick G directing a Mindhunter?
I think Ted Bundy would be, like, the natural way to go, because it's like an escalation. Like, even Manson, like, is one where, especially, like, I feel like Ted Bundy is more, like, I don't know, because...
Well, Ted Bundy actually killed people.
Well, Ted Bundy, too.
Isn't Ted Bundy also, like, kind of like what Ed Kemper was warning Holden about, where, like, Ted Bundy was kind of more normal?
Yeah.
And didn't come from, like, a broken family.
Yeah, he was just a handsome
dude. He was just a handsome,
young, handsome Republican.
Yeah. Which he wasn't that handsome.
Yeah, suicide hotline guy.
Yeah. I don't know, like I don't know. We're just gonna have to
see. Zac Efron to reprise his role.
Listen,
the same universe.
Listen, I'd be okay with it.
Well, and like, you know, I mean, obviously Manson is having a resurgence because it's the 50th anniversary of the Tate murders.
Yes.
But also, Ted Bundy had a bit of a resurgence because you had the Ted Bundy tapes. You had the Zac Efron movie.
Yeah.
So it feels like a natural progression, and I think that would definitely be the way to go.
Yeah.
I'm all for it. That's definitely the best
fingers
idea.
Fingers crossed. Get it done, Finchie. Let's do it. I mean, obviously we gave our whole thoughts. Any wrap up final thoughts, Steven? Final thoughts on the season?
It was great. I think it was a great expansion of the first season. I do like what you guys said about the first one being like proof of concept, and then season two kind of being like where it can go. Where it's just a better version of CSI.
Yeah.
Honestly, yeah, the casting is just A++++++. Like, yeah. Seriously. I'd give it a solid A, like A to A plus for the whole season. I'd give it an A plus.
All right.
I'd give it a C.
I mean, like, I know I'm always, like, the first one of the three of us to try to play devil's advocate, but even, like, trying, like, there's a solid defense for everything. So, like, I really can't say it's bad or in any way bad.
Well, it's one of those things where even the weaker elements are still portrayed so well.
Oh, yeah.
That's like, you don't care. Like, like we talked about the Wendy scenes. It's like, the Wendy scenes are still written really well, shot really well,
yeah.
You know? performed really well. Like, you know, the bowling scene that I brought up earlier. Mm-hmm. It's like, that's just kind of a short film. Like, it's a nice little short film about, like, a date night.
Oh, yeah,
between these sure. two ladies. And it's just, like, really kind of sweet.
Yeah.
And it's just
what
great.
People tune in for Mindhunter for, but it's good regardless.
But it's a nice little bonus. Like, thank you.
Yeah. Exactly.
So, Neil.
No, I'd give it an A. Nothing that I can say hasn't already been said, so it's like, I'm just gonna...
You can say you said it beforehand.
It's possible. I'll just say it was worth the 2 years. I just hope I don't have to wait another 2 years. We probably will.
Or I'll even be fine with waiting 2 years if it means we get a third season.
If it means we get a third season.
And yeah, I am willing to wait another 2 years.
Yeah, I'll wait another 2 years. I think... I don't honestly know if we're going to get 5 seasons. If we don't, that's okay. But I really hope that... I mean, I'll take 3 seasons in a movie. But, like, if we just get a third season and they know it's going to be their third, I would like that very much.
Yeah.
If they ended on their own terms, it'd be like...
I want them to end it on their
three,
own terms.
It'll three get seasons. A third season, and then, like, 20 years later, there'll be, like, a made-for-TV movie that goes straight to Netflix, like, a la the Rocko's Modern Life thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Or just, because it's 20 years in the future, it's just, like, injected right into our veins.
Listen, I'm okay with it. But, yeah, no, that's what I have to say. There you go.
Yeah. I'm in full agreement. I would go so far as Mindhunter is the best show on Netflix.
It is.
No, I will say it's
granted,
the best
granted, show Netflix canceled half their fucking shows.
Yeah.
But, yeah. It's the best show on Netflix.
If you're not Stranger Things, you're on the bubble.
Yeah. Yeah. In my opinion, it's the best show on Netflix. I think it's accessible. I think it handles its subject matter in a very nuanced, like, very deft hand, very...
Yeah.
There's a lot of care in it. Like, you might look at, like, oh, yikes, like, you know, like, Neil, you said you were worried about, like, you had a little concern about the white savior angle possibility.
That's, yeah, that was Holden. That was the one thing, yeah, because when I heard that they were going to do the Atlanta child murders, my first thought was, oh, shit, that's awesome, that case doesn't have enough recognition.
Yeah.
Immediately followed by... oh, God, this can go really bad. So yeah. I definitely had a what, hell yeah, what moment.
Right. And they didn't do that.
And
it's
they
great.
Did not do that at all.
Yeah, it definitely had, like, Crash 2006 potential.
It really did. And they went so hard in the other direction.
It's almost like hiring a black filmmaker to direct those episodes
and
frame that is a good thing.
Well, it was just having that innate sense of curiosity and empathy.
Yeah.
Because, like, if you even try to say, like, oh, yeah, the Atlanta child murders, they're done, those solved, you are a fucking moron.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and it's such a... It's not quite a gut punch at the end.
Yeah.
But it's definitely like, oh, fuck. Like, it's definitely kind of like a poignant...
It's a great ending because the ending shows that the people who are declaring it done are the same people who didn't want to investigate it to begin with.
Yep.
And are celebrate... Like, the same people that are celebrating that it's done are the same people who wanted nothing to do with it. The methodology is kind of flawed, and it shows that it may have actually it didn't really prove shit.
It's almost like the U.S. criminal justice system is heavily flawed.
Yeah,
and that's one of the mission statements of Mindhunter season 2.
Yeah,
fucking watch it.
Exactly, and then basically nobody leaves that case feeling good.
Nope.
Yeah.
Except maybe Gunn.
Except for maybe Gunn.
It's well, not. I mean, it's not a gut punch. It's like a speeding ticket.
Yeah.
Like, oh man, this is gonna be expensive.
It's like when you watch a movie. You pop in a movie from the 90s, and it's an opening shot of like the New York skyline. You see the World Trade Center.
You're like,
oh, man.
It's the Ninja Turtles movie.
Yeah.
Or like, every Ninja Turtles.
It's everyone except the bad one. The objectively like worst one.
Or like when you turn on the Little Giant. And they say something like, you know, oh yeah, or oh yeah, I put $5 of gas into my car this morning, and I'm like, oh man.
You start crying.
Why are you
crying at this Rick Moranis movie?
I've been getting a lot of that playing a Resident Evil 2 remake because the opening is at a gas station.
Oh man.
And it's like literally like $1.09 a gallon. I'm like, no, I remember that.
Yep.
I remember when gas was like $1.20 or something.
Yeah.
But yeah, I would say if you're at all a fan of David Fincher, obviously you'll probably have watched it already.
Yes.
If you're a fan of Zodiac, if you're a fan of true crime,
yeah.
And you're just kind of, cause that's kind of how I am when it comes to like, I'm picky with true crime media.
Yeah.
Like mm-hmm. I don't watch every single thing.
I think a lot of it's gross.
A lot of it's gross. A lot of it's
sensationalized.
Weird. Yeah. You know, if you want something better than fucking Investigation Discovery,
yeah,
then and my man, I got you covered.
And I say this as someone who loves Investigation Discovery, but
for all the wrong reasons.
But also completely is like, this is the grossest of the gross.
Yeah.
Aside from maybe like My Favorite Murder. I'm sorry, I have opinions.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, like, if you want something better than that, then Mindhunter is for you.
Well, it's also, there's kind of something for everybody. You've got the true crime aspect, you got the characters, you got, you know.
Mindhunter is somewhere between My Favorite Murder and Last Podcast on the left.
That's fair.
As far as sensibilities
go. That's fair. Well, I mean, like, I was hanging out with my girlfriend at Dragon Con, and one of her coworkers had, like, kind of, like, didn't trash talk Last Podcast on the left, but she had some criticisms for it. But she's also a huge My Favorite Murder fan, and I was like, I don't know. I think a lot of the things you're throwing at Last Podcast, you can kind of throw at My Favorite Murder. But also, like, it was just like our different points of view, and I also like Emily agreed with her on a couple things, and I told her like, no, those are all completely legit. Like, it's definitely your mileage may vary. You will get different things out of it. Like, I personally love just about everything about that podcast, but I can understand someone going like, Henry goes too far. I don't like when they get off topic. You know, like, I can understand that.
I listened to some older ones during lunch.
Boy, they're rough.
Got, like, one of them just right out of the gate, Hong Kong. Henry Zebrowski is like, ooh, you want a gut punch.
They're rough.
Asian accent Henry Zebrowski is bad.
Yeah.
Wow. Take it easy, Mike Boudet, is all I'm going to say.
I will maybe kind of defend it when he does Charles Ng.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, like, that's how Charles Ng actually sounded.
Yeah, Charles Ng was like...
And the joke is...
He was like Ted Cruz, where he tried to, like, lean into, like, the stereotypes and the jokes, where, like, Ted Cruz, like, tries to lean into, like, the Zodiac.
Yeah, but then it's not funny. Yeah, it's like, shut the fuck up, Ted.
Yeah.
Well, the thing with Charles Ng, like, the joke isn't that he's doing an Asian accent. It's the personality that he assigns to Charles,
which
is just like really insecure
and
completely oblivious. Like, that's where it comes from. But anyways, yeah, even then, you could still, if someone is like, yeah, I'm not a fan of this Charles Ng, you're like, that's legit.
Yeah, yeah.
That's fine. You're totally allowed to think that. Anyways, sorry.
Anyway, back to our shitty podcast.
Yeah.
Anyway, watch Mindhunter, please.
We got done dunking on, like, podcasts with millions of listeners.
Yeah.
Yeah, fuck them. Listen to Geeks at Large. We're better.
Yeah.
10 out of 10. Would recommend ourselves.
My mom listened to it, and she said I sounded so lovely.
My mom listened to it, and she said she's disappointed.
Oh, my God.
So anyway, watch Mindhunter, please, because I want a third season. Please, Daddy Fincher, give it to me.
All right.
Anyway, I don't know. I don't know how to end this. Fuck this. What are we talking about? Okay. Say goodbye, Neil.
Goodbye, Neil.
Say goodbye, Steven.
Goodbye, Steven.
Anyway, go fast, eat ass. Kicks will remain at large.